Honorable members, I wish to extend a sincere apology for the chairperson. He's unable to attend this meeting because he had an operation, so he's booked off till the 21st of September. Therefore, in the absence of the chairperson, according to the rules of Parliament, Rule 130, Subsection 1, calls for the nomination of an acting chairperson. Then I will call for nomination. Thank you. Any nomination? Any seconder for the nomination? Thank you. No further. Honorable Matlanyana, you are nominated as an acting chair of the chairperson. In terms of Rule 131, Subsection 2, an acting chairperson performs the functions and may exercise the powers of the chairperson. Thank you. Can come up. Thank you, honorable members, and because we are starting very late and we thought this is going to be a workshop where we are going to have a day that we are going to go through our needs as a committee on capacity, and we started late, and I wish to just extend that we apologize sincerely because we started somewhere and we came late. Maybe let's hope that's not the reason that the committee was delayed. We thought that the committee was going to continue without us. But we welcome all present, and we can we just check if there are any apologies? Thank you, ma'am. We've got an apology for the chair, an apology for Honorable Tandala, apology for Honorable Ndapane, apology for Honorable Dichetelo, apology for Honorable Nchabeleng. He might join us late. And I know that Honorable Musi has gone out with the Portfolio Committee on Sport. They are conducting oversight in the province. Thanks. Thank you, Secretary. Okay, honorable members, we received SMSs and notification to indicate that as members, we need to identify tools that will be enable us to be able to perform our responsibilities as this portfolio committee, most especially on capacity building. And I'm not sure if the secretary received any input from members, but based on our strategic planning workshop, we felt that there is a need for us to sit down as a portfolio committee and have a thorough discussion on our needs, on things that will assist us or to be capacitated in order to fulfill our responsibility, most especially on this mammoth task that was given to us. And On the 26th of August, we decided that we need today so that we sit down and do exactly that, identify what will ensure that we are able as a portfolio committee to fulfill our responsibility. And the overall purpose of today is to ensure that we enhance our knowledge and skills and so that we are able to carry out our mandate effectively. That is of overseeing the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform and its entire entities. And our objective for today is to lay out a foundation for ongoing processes of development and enhancement of capacity within the committee to engage with relevant policy and its implementation. The second one is to provide detailed information on available capacity building opportunities and support to members, both within and outside Parliament, and to begin with processes for drafting a program for capacity building for the committee based on the group and individual needs that will be identified. And we know for a fact that some of us are not even able to understand what legislation is, and we need that capacity. And on that scale, I will request our content advisor, Mr. Chililo Manenze, to give us an analysis of the committee needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning, Honorable Members. We thought we should start by, start the day by looking at all the training needs that were identified by members. Just immediately after the meeting that was held, which actually saw it important or deemed it necessary that this workshop be held. Now, what I'm going to be presenting here is an analysis of what honourable members sent to PUMLA in terms of what they consider to be crucial training needs for this committee. Now, this presentation, in terms of an outline, I'll just give a brief background, but also go on to talk about what capacity building is, and then go straight into what you identified as training needs and how we sort of categorized them and look at what sort of program will emerge out of that. And then we conclude. So it's a very short presentation on what you raised. Now, as the Honorable Chairperson, Acting Chairperson here has mentioned, that this whole process emanates from a strategic planning process for this committee, which highlighted capacity building and development as one of the key strategic objectives. And there was a recognition, during the workshop that majority of members of this committee are new in this portfolio, and some of them are new in Parliament. And also the fact that in South Africa, after the elections, there was realignment of ministries that saw the establishment of the Ministry for Rural Development and Land Reform, and hence we also had a portfolio committee that looks into rural development and land reform to oversee the ministry and the department. So, if you will remember, at the workshop collectively, members or participants identified some of the training needs which they considered relevant. And I'm not going to emphasize that the meeting that we're referring to, which said we should have this workshop, also resolved that we need to start the process today in terms of analysis and saying what do we do going forward. Now, this whole presentation, it actually sets out a basis for discussion based on the needs submitted by some of the members. I must say that not all members were able to submit training needs, but some did try by all means to make sure that they forward what they call their individual training needs. Now, we're talking about capacity building, and what is this concept? What does this concept mean when we're saying capacity building? And I sort of liked the definition which is found in this document called Agenda 21, which looks at capacity building with a sort of a fundamental goal of, you know, it gives a goal for capacity building, which is to enhance the ability to evaluate and address crucial questions related to policy choices and modes of implementation among development options based on an understanding of the environment potentials and limits and the needs perceived by the people of the country concerned. Now, it looks at capacity building not as, you know, something that is outside the needs of the people of a particular country. So it's the need of the, you know, the country, but also the capacity or the ability to evaluate and address, you know, policy questions and how these policies are being implemented. And I thought this is a relevant way to define capacity building, particularly looking at what the committee needs to do in terms of the constitutional mandate. Now, at a very superficial level, capacity building can be equated to training. But if you look at training, it ends up benefiting individuals, but not looking at the committee as an institution. What I'm trying to say is we may give individuals specific skills, but leave the core around a capacity, you know, systems and process that capacitate the committee as a group. Giving an example, if you give members skills, but you don't address strategies, you don't address the strategic plan and what needs to be achieved. So sometimes the skills don't relate to what the strategic direction of that particular institution or committee is. So it's very important to actually think about around capacity building beyond training, but looking at training at an individual level, even going into the systems and processes within the committee that enhances the ability to work, to perform responsibilities efficaciously. The committee, therefore, understands capacity building as a process by which the committee as a collective and individuals develop and or enhance skills, knowledge to organize systems, resources, knowledge as reflected in their capabilities to perform their constitutional mandate. Now, if we are going to be engaging in capacity building initiatives, we must target not only individuals, but also we must look at the committee as an entity and the resources that it has to ensure that these members are capacitated and the committee at large. Now, there's also one quotation which I picked up from the report of an independent panel assessment of Parliament, which actually says that effectiveness of Parliament's oversight work is directly related to the independence of the institution. So you're giving an independent voice. And the ability of individual members of Parliament to raise critical voice against shortcomings identified in other organs of state, particularly the executive. So this report actually emphasizes that when we talk about effectiveness of Parliament, it's not only about Parliament at a broader level, but it goes specifically down to individual members of Parliament to be able to say, there's a problem with this particular policy, there's a problem, there's a gap in this area. I'd be able to identify those shortcomings and address them. So it's about analysis, evaluation, and saying what needs to be done. So on that note, I mean, we should see capacity building process, you know, as a process, not as a once-off event, not just as a training one day, which you cannot link to the strategy of the committee or goals and objectives that are set. So it's an ongoing process, which as I said before, it's not only aimed at skills transfer, but it is also a process which put the committee in a strategic position of power and influence in policies, policy choices, and modes of implementation. So very strategically, the committee gets located in a manner that whenever the department stands here, it's able to challenge, it's able to raise questions, it's able to raise that critical voice. So what I'm saying is it's medium to long-term in nature and addressing, you know, a range of levels. I've spoken about an individual that needs to be assisted. In some instances, capacity is there. It has to be enhanced and supported. In some instances, it's a new area of work, and you need to develop that and assist a particular individual to develop. But also, the committee is another level, wherein as a collective. So you move from individual to a committee. And actually, the environment as well, which by environment, I'm referring to the policy environment, not only the in terms of the external policies, but also internal in terms of parliament, not the committee. How do those systems and policies that are in place enhance the capacity of the committee to perform their functions effectively? So it's not only about skills, it's not only about knowledge, but also about relationships, about values, about attitudes. I always say, as someone that is working in a particular sector, for you also to be effective, it also requires you to have that passion about that particular area that you are working in. And that's what I'm talking about values and attitudes as well. The last thing that I want to talk about in terms of capacity building and training is that to enable the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform to raise critical voice against shortcomings, capacity building program, and this is a proposal, will focus on knowledge base. That here we're talking about formal and non-formal education, training initiatives, and independent reading. That is, you actually read about what is happening in the sector, what is happening in the field. All this, it also has to reflect on an individual to say that if I'm working in the rural development and land reform, whenever I pick up a newspaper, what I look at is what is the newspaper saying in my field. Whenever I go to the bookstore and I look at books that are talking about issues from the field. So this is what I'm talking about when I refer to independent reading. Formal education, you know, throughout the day or this session, there are people that are also going to be speaking about what other opportunities exist in terms of supporting members in training and education. So I'm not going to dwell much on that because other people will further highlight on that. The next thing that I think is very important, and this is actually reflecting on the strategic plan but also on what members raise as their training needs, is alignment of the strategic focus. This speaks to what the committee stands for and what needs to achieve in relation to the mandate of the committee, but as well as the strategic plan of the department and what department says it needs to achieve by a particular year, if you look at their strategic plan. So all this has to be aligned. And I refer to intellectual resources. One example of an intellectual resource would be your strategic planning document, which articulates what this committee stands for and what it needs to be achieved over a certain period of time. Also, I refer to the committee strategy is linked to the strategic plan, but also networks and partnerships. One of the things that will also help this committee in terms of enhancing its capacity to engage effectively is what sort of networks this committee has and partnerships. For instance, if this committee is working in rural development, this committee cannot at all, you know, throughout the year be out there. But there are NGOs, there are CBOs, there are research institutions and different organizations, you know, a range of civil society organizations that are working in the field, that are there on a daily basis. How do we tap into their knowledge base, their resources, their publications, to ensure that we actually strengthen as a committee to perform and implement our mandate effectively? So it's very important to look at that. And the another way to look at it is actually at the policy level, strengthening the internal aspects of policies. One one thing that I thought about here is actually rules that are here in Parliament to enable committees to function, the Constitution. You think about the oversight and accountability model. These are things that, you know, there will be slot to talk about today, so I'm not going to be emphasizing that. But also the external, looking at the policies in the sector, rural development and land reform, you know, outside, you know, implemented by government. So I, looking at what members raised, I thought this would be a critical sort of area that the committee can focus on in terms of developing or enhancing capacity to perform or to act on its mandate effectively. Now, this slide gives you what you honourable members raised at what as what you consider as training needs. The first one, I'll just read through them because it's just a list of what members raised. It's I must say that I put Money Bills, Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act because one of the needs that came was it was not straight to the point, but it said an act that was recently passed by Parliament. And we had a question whether it's this act or it's the FAPLA, whether it's FAPLA. So, but I think we can get clarity from honourable members. I have analysis and scrutiny of budget, annual reports, and they were thinking about the use of Auditor General's report, Treasury regulations. This is one critical area that members felt that we need to look at. The third one is around linking committee work with Chapter 9 institutions. Think about the Human Rights the Human Rights Commission. And in this committee, we're also dealing with human rights issues, particularly on the farm. You know, there are a lot of violations of human rights in farms that gets reported, and Human Rights Commission do a lot of work in that. But also being a rural development committee, there's nothing stopping us in terms of identifying issues even from the rural areas. So how does this committee use those reports to enhance their its oversight responsibilities? There was also a talk about the Planning Commission in the presidency, in the office of in the presidency, and also the monitoring and evaluation unit in the presidency. How do we, I mean, these are institutions that are set up to actually assist in service delivery. How does, as a committee, begin to make sure that there's a link in terms of how the committee approach its work on a daily basis? How do we ensure that there's, and what sort of links does the committee want to see? So it's another area that came up as a critical area that the committee will have to look at going forward. Then other one is integrating constituency work, public queries, to committee work. And members go out on constituency days and they get public queries. How do you integrate that into your normal day-to-day committee work? The other one is the oversight and accountability model. There's going to be a presentation on this today. The another one is the being a committee that looks at rural development and land reform. There's a need that says we have to look at policy and legal framework for rural development and land reform. What are the policies in place and what are the laws in place and what's the framework within which the department operates? The strategic planning workshop also raised critical questions around having passed a lot of legislation but weaknesses in implementation, that this also leads to a beginning of a process in review of those. There was a general need identified around a policy analysis and review. That is like a generic way, how do you analyze policies? How do you review policies? And the last one was on monitoring and evaluation. And I think when you talk about oversight, part of what you do is to monitor what government is doing and come and also do an evaluation of say, the work that was done over a specific period of time. Now, having raised all those, the list of quests of needs, and we try to sort of cluster them into broad categories to say, what does this mean for this committee? There's a need to look at oversight. That is oversight and accountability model, public finance and spending, government performance against its own strategic plan. That's like one critical area to look at. It's performance based on the plans, but also the implementation of legislation, a key area that what those needs raised actually reflects. And we thought that as some of the submissions mentioned, that National Treasury and the Auditor General, the Office of the Auditor General, can assist in building capacity in this. And actually, Parliament itself might also have systems in place to capacitate committees or Parliament in general with regard to these issues. The next category is around content. It's a particular, I called it sector content for lack of a better way, but we're looking at content in this particular sector that we're working in. We're looking at policy and legal framework, but go on to say how has the implementation of policies continued in South Africa, and what are the challenges and implications going forward? So these are the issues that we'll have to look at. Another critical area under the content which is specific to this sector is around international agreements which are relevant to these policies. Reading at that report of the panel assessment of Parliament, one of the things that we think is around weaknesses in ensuring that there is compliance with international, there is a lack of oversight into compliance of government on international agreements. So we actually now have to stand back and say, what are the relevant agreements, treaties, and protocols for this portfolio? And how is the department making sure that they comply? Give an example. The general one that we can all talk about is the Millennium Development Goals. With this department, how is it ensuring that as a country we are able to comply with targets that are set? There are a lot of agreements that one can even talk about. For instance, there's what we call ICAD, which is an international convention on agrarian and rural development, which South Africa is also a signatory to that. And how do we make sure that we look into some of those agreements and make sure that our government also will comply to that? And bear in mind that we're actually having in mind the betterment of the lives of the people. And research institutions, NGOs, and universities that are doing research in these particular areas can also help. And the last part is about legislation and policy analysis, one category that I have identified. Why is this relevant? We know the department is going to be reviewing the white paper on South African land policy. This committee said laws such as EFTA, Extension of Security of Kenya Act, have to be looked at, have to be reviewed. Now, this committee has to be in a position where they are able to engage in that review. Now, what we're saying is that based on what you said, it's important that this program be held. And it would be useful, perhaps, to make sure that we are able to compress our training, perhaps in this and the next 2 years, so that the last 2 years we're able to just to go on and work based on what we have. But also remember that I said I see it as an ongoing thing. So it doesn't mean that once a particular training is done, that's the end of it. But it has to, continue. By, for instance, with individual reading and stuff. And the program might look at having certificates, diplomas, and all that. And some of this would require a longer period of time above the 209 and 212 proposed dates. To implement this program, it would require commitment from members of the committee. It would require time and financial resources to enable members to participate in training, seminars, and conferences. Internal committee systems to enable the flow of information, scrutiny of documents, like briefing documents, strategic plans, and annual reports, budget reports, as you know, financial statements and financial reports, and dedicated staff. In short, this is what you raised as your training needs and how I see them going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm sure members have some input and clarification to make on the presentation, but I would propose that we take Mr. Mikana. I have a problem in pronouncing that surname. So we take the three presentations. It's two, Mr. Mikana, and then that we'll be able to ask questions, and then the presenters will be able to identify questions, or members must be in a position to state which question is referred to who exactly. So I'll call upon Mr. Mikana.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. My name is Simelelo Nyikana. I am the Program Manager in the Member Services Section. We report to the Secretary to Parliament. My responsibilities in Parliament is to provide capacity building for members, which includes the provision of training and also other support related issues like laptops, computers, and other tools of trade. my presentation is going to be brief, taking from what my colleague has alluded to in his presentation. But just before I get into my presentation, I would like to commend the committee for taking the initiative to work out their own training needs. In the previous parliament, we have had difficulties getting committees to assist us develop their training needs. As a result, the area around the sector-specific training, which focuses more on the committee, is an issue that is still gray. There are very few committees that have really come up with programs that deals with sector-specific issues. I can mention about three committees: science and technology, minerals and energy, and the portfolio committee on communications. that we have in the past managed to work with them and have developed sector-specific programs. This has more got to do with the challenges that members have in terms of the programming and also the management of their time. Taking cue from the presentation and the fact that it is of interest to us the work that the committee has done, I have looked at the categories that my colleague has identified, which is public finance, policy formulation, and oversight function. I can assure the committee that those three categories, Parliament is well advanced in terms of capacitating members in. I am sure that as we work together, we will be able to define, interrogate, and come up with a program on the sector-specific content. It's a new committee, and most of these areas would require that we work as a team. This week, we were supposed to start working on the baseline need assessment for all members of Parliament, including their committee-specific needs. It was opportune for me when I was told that this committee is meeting and they want to work on their training needs, that I took the opportunity to bring along the training needs forms that I request the committee members to complete and prepare to complement what was already discussed at the strategic planning session. Basically, as my colleague has alluded, that capacity building goes beyond just training. The area of my presentation will focus specifically on training and what we had in the previous parliament and how moving forward we can work as a team. Our programs are meant to enhance the skills, knowledge, and competencies of members to fulfill their constitutional objectives. We integrate personal needs with the organizational objectives in order to develop accredited training programs that ensures that as members leave towards the end of the term, they leave with portable skills. In the previous parliaments, we have had training which was not accredited and did not have any articulation in terms of the current higher education legislation. This created challenges for us because some members who would have acquired expertise and experience over 10 years in a particular community found themselves not having any certificates because at the current moment, the South African society is fixated on qualifications and certificates. Most of our people who have left between 94 and 99, some of them, as we speak now, are unemployed despite having accumulated so much experience. Because if you go to any government department, you go to any corporate company, they will tell you that they require a degree they require certificates of competence in a particular sector. And the work that members do in Parliament is so unique and so advanced that we felt that it's very important that we should work out accredited training programs. Before I get on the programs that we have, I just want to highlight how our governance structure is. At Political Management, all our training programs are managed by the Deputy Speaker and the Deputy Chairperson from the NCOT. They work with the House Chairperson from the two houses. And normally, in the previous term, there was a training committee which was made up of members from the different parties. Below them, it was my office, which is short-staffed. I'm the only person at this stage with the two admin assistants to design, develop, and coordinate the facilitation of programs. Basically, the responsibilities of the POs is to provide and guide us in terms of the development of the programs, and they also approve the broad program plans and budget. They get this information from the steering committee, which work together with us to identify the training needs, develop some deliverables, approve the changes in the scope, and as and when we require additional funding. They do that on behalf of the training steering committee. On the hard copies that I gave you, the information that I'm presenting is there. The programs that we offer the orientation programs. I'm sure honorable members, when they came to Parliament in May, they participated in the induction program that we offer. Over and above this once-off 5 to 10 days induction, we also offer the induction during the midterm as and when members, we get new members. But over and above that, we offer functional and specialized learning. These are programs that talk to the sector-specific program, where you would have, where we work with the various sitters and committees and institutions of higher learning to develop specialized functional training programs for members. In my introduction, I alluded to the training that we had with the Department of, with the Portfolio Committee on Minerals and Energy, where we worked with the Mining Qualification Authority, and we developed the program for that particular sector. Unfortunately, as I had indicated, not all committees have sector-specific training programs. We do hope that in this current parliamentary term, we should be able to target all committees and have sessions of this nature in order to develop these programs. But over and above that, we have academic programs that we implemented. We had a pilot program that we ran on the leadership development program. On the hard copies that I sent, that I distributed, on the last two pages, you'll see the details of the program. It's of a leadership development program and also the program on the economic and public policy. I'm glad to announce that the Honorable Chair is one of the students in the economics program. I will talk briefly about the program. We started the program with a certificate in public finance with UNISA. From that certificate, we developed another program with the University of Western Cape, which is more of an advanced diploma in economic and public policy. And currently, we have the last group completing their honors in that program. The feedback that we've received is that both at individual and at committee level, we've seen improvement in the members that are attending our program. In fact, most of the members that participated in our programs are holding very senior positions, both in government and in the private sector, which it's a reflection that these programs do work. If you look at the model that we used to develop the program, we took into cognizance that some of our members don't have matric. And hence, while we have a legislation that deals with the RPL, which is the recognition of prior learning, most of the universities don't implement RPL. As a result, it's very difficult to get access to higher education, as if, despite the fact that they say they have the RPL. So what we've done is we've gone to some of the universities and negotiated a certificate that we will use as an entrance and will be recognized as an entrance to a higher qualification. UNISA and UWC and Rhodes University are part of the program, and they have agreed to work with us in that aspect to enable members who do not have matric to start at that level. But we are also cognizant of the fact that members are at different levels in terms of education, experience, and expertise. The design of all our programs take into account the multiple entry points and also multiple entry exits. In that, we want to ensure that we don't have a blanket approach in terms of the programs that we run, where we expect everybody to attend the same while they are at different levels. I'm not going to dwell much because most of the information is on the hard copies that I've distributed. You may look at those programs. Currently, we are currently reviewing the programs with a view to develop a new program for this term. The learning framework is still the same, and I will talk later about the learning framework. But over and above these programs that we have developed using competencies required for members to fulfill their obligations, we offered bursaries to members in the previous term. Some members took advantage of that, and I think we have about 4 members currently doing PhDs. And we had about 12 who were doing master's programs. We have received requests in this term, but unfortunately, most of our programs have not yet been approved by the current presiding officers. So the starting point is to ensure that we gather the training needs of all members, and based on those needs, we should be able to have the programs up and running. But over and above that, we offered exchange programs to members in the previous term. I do hope that the presiding officers will approve this, because in principle, they have approved pending the detail of how we proceed with this for the current parliamentary term. But over and above that, we have moved from working in silos. At the moment, the legislatures were not cooperating, whereby you have the same programs with different outputs and outcomes being implemented in various legislatures. You have the same program on policy formulation. But when you look at the content, you find out it's different, and also the articulation in terms of the qualification was at different levels. And now through the legislative sector framework, we are working with the legislatures to develop the program that has got the same content of modules and courses, which will have the same standards, which will be accredited at the same level, and the content itself will be informed by our core and essential competencies. The framework is the learning framework. It's not different from the one that we've implemented in the past. We will continue to have foundation programs, and we are going to match some of the modules that you, if you have looked at the last two pages, to work towards the one qualification, which is the postgraduate diploma in governance and leadership. And over and above that, we will have programs that will lead to the master's or enroll members through bursaries to the master's program. Basically, the way the certificate will work is that once you complete the certificate, you will have the number of credits towards the MPA with the institutions that will be participating in the program. But the idea is that the institutions from the various provinces will have to be part of the process to enable the easy movement of members. If a member moves from the parliament to the legislature, you still give an option for that member to continue with the work with another university, because the content, the qualification, and the accreditation is the same. These are some of the modules. They are not cast in stone. They are informed by the work that we've done in the past. The final modules that we will be rolling out will be informed by the training needs analysis and also the review that is currently going on the current programs that we have. I'm not going to go through this. In terms of our plans, we are currently working on the training needs assessment. I've asked Pumla to assist and distribute the training needs forms, and I request members to complete, because these are self-administered. Members should be able to complete within 2 to 3 minutes. We don't want to assume what you need. We know what are the competences that are required for members, but we don't know some of the sector-specific issues. In order for us to validate what we want to do, we still request your input on the program so that we know that we are on the right path. This process is supposed to be complete by September, by the end of this month. And we intend developing a new program in November, in October, with the enrollment at the end of November. And the actual training program will take place in January, February next year. And if you want to access our services. I think this committee is on the right path. Normally, the committees need to, through their strategic and business planning processes, identify their training needs and develop and encapsulate those in the in their business plan, which gets approved on the basis of the approval. We, together with the committee support staff, develop terms of reference and request for quotations. Once we have done that, we send those to the presiding officers, starting with the House Chairs of Committees, for approval. It's then that we roll out. I think it's these are more technical issues that has got to do with the committee section, not members. But it's very important for members to know that while we work, while there are limited resources within the higher education sector, in terms of our own procurement processes, the process takes longer because we require more than 5 quotations on training before we can run the program. There has been a tendency of committees to work with one particular service provider, and hence you would hear that some of the committee chairpersons were complaining that the processes are taking far too long because the approval of one service provider, it is a challenge, especially now with the FAPLA. I think that's it. In terms of bursaries, the process it's different. Members, they identify the training that they want to undertake. They go to those universities or contact them to register. Once members have been accepted by those, then they come to my office and then complete the application form. Once that has been approved by the presiding officers, then that members can enroll and attend the program. I think that's it. And those are my details at the back of the...
Thank you, Mr. Nyikana. At long last, I got it right. Members, there it is. Do we have any input, any questions to the two presenters? Mr. Swate? Ms. Mabila? Ngwenya Mabila?
Good morning. Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is actually to Mr. Nyikani with regard to members going to universities, identifying the course that they actually want to undertake or to study. I just wanted to find out, because here when we ask for this, we actually wanted to do it in as a committee. Is it not going to actually divide us, where you'll find another member in there, another one there, not doing it as a group? So I just want to find out as to whether it's not going to actually divide us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is based on the bazaars. Since I've indicated that the National Assembly is assisting members with bazaars, is there any minimum or maximum amount in place so that when you look at the programs and also the courses, you can be able to check whether you are within the limit that is being offered by the assembly. Then secondly, on the presentation that has been made by Manen, is it correct? Yes, somewhere you talk about the linking of the community work with other communities. It's unfortunate because it's like this is a comment, it's not a question, because you indicated that other committees that this committee must link with, must be working with. I think public accounts is one of the committees that this committee also must be able to work with, viewing the fact that this committee were considering the performance audit and partially the financial performance of the department. Why the public accounts committee specifically deals with the financial performance of the department. Maybe working together with that committee can be able to strengthen our oversight so that at the end of the day, while as this committee considering the performance of the department on service delivery, we link it with the with their financial performance as it is being done by the public accounts committee. Again, I think as this committee, we need to to work with the House of Traditional Leaders, because we're talking of the rural development. Since this most, when talking of the rural areas, most of them are being controlled and managed by traditional leaders. I think it will assist this committee a lot if we're working hand in glove with the House of Traditional Leaders so that we strengthen our communication and also our working. Then again, you touch the issue of the lack of oversight on international agreements. You know, in most cases, what we talk of these agreements, protocols, and whatever. But in most cases, you find that the members of the committees are not even aware of those agreements that are being signed by, international agreements that are being signed by department, hoping that their research section has to assist us to have access to those agreements so that at the end of the day, we are able to monitor the implementation of all the conventions and also the agreements that have been signed by various, specifically by this department that we are playing oversight on. Thank you very much.
Honorable Chavele.
Technologically challenged. Chairperson, we belong to more than one committee. Like I belong to this and the Committee on Energy. Is there a limit in terms of study? Is it one person, one course at a time? Or can a person, based on their capacities, I identify my needs on energy and say I want to do something on PPMR and then do something on legal framework on rural development? That's two diplomas and they don't talk to each other. You know, will I be granted that opportunity of doing two diplomas at a time for advancement of my interest to improve my participation and input in the committee? And the other question will go to Umanenge. Is there a way where, as committees, as part of our learning, that we can attach people, not only in attending classes, but actually going out and doing field work with NGOs as part of imparting skills? Let's say, for instance, there's an NGO that is doing a research on something related to rural development, particularly on land reform. You know, will we be afforded that opportunity as members if we apply? to go and learn from that NGO.
Thank you once more. I only asked one question. I actually wanted to ask two questions, but anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity. My second question is actually to Mr. Menenze with regard to training on oversight and accountability model. I think that to me is very much important, and I just wanted to know as to whether, after having been capacitated in that regard, are we actually going to have a power or something that is going to enable us of what we have actually learned on the ground when we're doing oversight to make sure that all those other things that we report on are acted upon by the department or the minister. So I just wanted to find out there, because some of the things that we are doing a lot of work and we come up with reports, and when we present the reports, it's just not being implemented. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Regarding oversight, there are so many reports that are done by each and every committee of this parliament, tabled in the House. But when you think that there must be some steps taken to make a follow-up regarding those reports, you find that there is nothing happening. That worries me when I'm thinking about this. And Parliament seems not to be effective, giving an effective result to those reports. We do the oversight during our constituencies, find so many things going wrong, come and report in this House, but you'll find that it's there. Those things are carrying on, not to stop it. Like as it is at the moment, you'll find that there are so many demonstrations complaining about the same thing that we have reported. We know it is happening outside. Maybe we have so many people who are given the power to do the oversight, but there are some other people to implement. We have no power to implement. And even when you have reported, you can't go back and say, I must implement or I must stop this. I'm worried about this because I can't understand what power the committee has to influence the policy of implementation. There are so many things that I can, you see. You have mentioned that there are NGOs, NPOs, CBOs to implement, even some recessions. But we are the legislators here in Parliament just to pass the legislation, but no power for implementation, giving the other people to implement. If they are unable to do that, we can't do anything. That is what worries me more than anything. I don't know how can you assist me to show that maybe we can do something. We make some monitoring. We get some requests from the people down there. They want this and this and this. You come back, you say, go straight to the minister. Minister, this is your department. Or let's say the people want a dam or they want a road. You go to the minister. The minister refers you to the provincial legislature. provincial legislator refers you to the local government councillor to do that, and you find ourselves just flowing in the air as if we have no power. I think I have those remarks only to ask, what are we supposed to do? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll hand over to the two presenters. Any one of you can start.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. On the first question on whether the issue of bursaries might not divide members, yes, I think it might, but my understanding of the program that needs to be developed, particularly at sector level, it is short courses that are between 5 days to 3 months, and I am not sure how members might have challenge with regard to that. The issue I would have is academic programs, particularly long-term ones. It is an individual effort, even if you do it as a group. Members need to take into account that most of the work needs to be done, and the intrinsic motivation must come from that particular member. While working as an integral part of the group. For us, it is more effective for us to monitor the effectiveness of the program if it's done within the committee level. But we are also aware that most of the committees are clustered, which makes it much more easier for members to acquire skills within that particular class as they migrate from one committee to another. I am not sure, because at this stage we don't have programs yet, but the programs we've had in the past, it's short programs. And secondly, because it's functional and specialized training, I don't see why members cannot do two or three programs. But if you link those to long-term programs, I'm sure there will be limits in terms of how many you can do. On the second question around the bursaries and the minimum, at this stage, we don't have any minimum. We currently do not have a policy for members of parliament. In the previous term, we used the interim policy for staff to offer bursaries to members, with the view that the policy for members will be developed and approved in the current parliamentary term. The policy has been developed, and it's with the presiding officers. I can't comment on the policy until we have received feedback. But of course, there are conditions, because if I can mention one or two, one of the challenges we had with the staff policy was that members are required to. If the members drop out of the program or fail, they are required to pay back Parliament. But the challenge we had is that members, not on problems of their own making, they are here in Parliament and get deployed in another province, and you can't really force a member to pay back. So it's only one of the many issues that the current draft policy is addressing. It's sitting with the presiding officers, and we do hope that before the end of next month, it should be approved, and it will address all issues around the minimum and the maximum. I think that's it.
Thanks. I welcome the comments around the integration of the work of this committee with other, you know, entities and other committees. I think it's a very useful committees, and one can even begin to think about committees in the NCOP that are actually doing this work. To say how does the two programs relate and work together, particularly, you know, generating work and oversight ideas also from the reports that they generate. So I think it's a very useful thing to actually look at, and also the issue around the House of Traditional Leaders as one of the authorities or institutions that the committee can work with. On international agreements, one of the things that it also came up from other meetings was that, and we've been discussing it among ourselves as staff, to say we actually need to look at a research document that says in this particular sector, what are the different agreements that are relevant and which we need to look at. And engage with those and get the department also to come and talk about. So this is something that we identified, and we thought we, at some stage in the future, once that research document is in place, we can come back together as a collective, as a committee, and discuss that issue. It's a very important issue. There's a question around attaching people to NGOs, attaching members to NGOs. I'm trying to find how best and how possible will it be, but my colleague here spoke about exchange programs. And you know, perhaps that can be one way that one can look at if there is a particular, it's not only a local NGO, it might be an international NGO that is doing work in a particular area, and you engage in an exchange program that helps members actually to learn from the practice, best practices in another country. You can begin to think about the study tours that this committee has also spoken about. So it's one area to look at. But I perhaps my colleague will assist me with regards, can you really attach members to a particular NGO, and I would find it a bit difficult. But I do know that members are coming from different constituencies, and in their constituency, while they do their constituency, perhaps they do engage with NGOs. And I think that is the way members can begin to learn and you know, more in terms of implementation of policies at a local level. So I think it needs a, you know, an innovative way in terms of how members can engage with NGOs in that particular area. I mean, I think if one gets attached to a particular NGO, might also create tensions that you end up perhaps getting one side of the story and not getting the other. So, but perhaps that's an area that we can look at. There were number of questions that were raised regarding oversight and accountability. I'm not going to be responding to that because there is a presentation that is going to be talking about this, and I think it would respond to some of the questions that members have. But Ms. Mene here would have responses to those questions because she's going to be speaking about oversight and accountability model. Perhaps you would want to respond to some of the questions that members raised, and we'll actually go on with the presentation afterwards.
Can I check first with members? Are we comfortable because the presentation is coming immediately after this? Can't we just say there's tea at the back, we grab tea, and then from there we allow her to continue with her presentation, then she'll be able to answer questions that are related to her after her presentation. Are we comfortable with it? Okay. Can we just grab tea and then come back immediately for Ms.?
In some instances, we'll find out the committee will say it wants a closed meeting. It's only members and the committee secretary to take notes. In some instances, the committee may decide that we want to have a closed meeting, even we are going to ask the committee secretary to excuse herself for whatever reason. And the way in which we record such meetings, especially if there was no committee secretary, is just to indicate that the committee had a closed meeting because there was no one to take records, because there were reasons for that. In terms of the mandate of the committee in terms of the constitution and in terms of the rules of parliament, they consider legislation referred to committees. They oversee the executive, and they facilitate public participation in the form of public hearings and in the form of going to the communities and have meetings with the communities to find out what is happening exactly at grassroots level. Usually that is done when the committee wants to see and check the service delivery at grassroots level. And the public hearings committee can have the public hearings at national level. When we're saying at national level, usually the committee will have their public hearings here in Parliament and invite the relevant stakeholders. This is usually happening especially during the process of considering legislation by the committee. But at the same time, the committee can have a public hearings at provincial level. This has happened before, and there's nothing stopping the committee. But what usually is crucial when we advise committees to have legislation, I mean public hearings in provinces, is to include the legislatures. And in some instances, if you want to have some very fruitful public participation, it's also even to include the executive. Because when you go there and get your findings, and when you come back, you engage with the department gives you a different version. So what we advise some of the committees, say if you want to go to Eastern Cape and have public hearings, you as a committee, you go, you also invite the legislature, the relevant committee of the legislature, but you also invite the relevant officials from that particular department, so that when you come back, you have a holistic approach in terms of what is happening there. And when you are doing that, you find out some of the issues can be resolved there and there when you are there. And at the same time, the committee has to consider the international agreements that are referred to them. I think the issue of international agreements was raised here to say that what can committees do to conduct oversight in terms of the international agreements that has been passed by Parliament. The challenge currently that Parliament is having is that in terms of our constitution, the issue, the signing of international agreements is the executive function. It is the executive that is signing all these international agreements. And in terms of the constitution, there are international agreements where the executive is just tabling them to Parliament for formality, for information purposes. It means that Parliament doesn't have to approve that international agreement. They are saying those are international agreements that are technical in nature. Therefore, they are saying to Parliament, we just signed this international agreement for information purposes. But there is a second set of international agreements where Parliament has to approve them before they are implemented. But even in those international agreements, Parliament comes at the end of the process. Because when these international agreements are tabled in Parliament, they have already been signed. They are just waiting implementation, just the Parliament to say, go ahead. We approve this and then we implement. Now the challenge is that when that happened, Parliament were not part of the negotiations and everything. They don't know the implications of this. And currently, what I will say, Parliament even itself, if I can be frank, it was like rubber stamping the international agreement because there's no engagement to understand fully what the international agreement are all about. And usually the implications and the impact of those international agreements will come 2 years or a year down the line when they're implemented. And when people are complaining, it's when Parliament will say, but why did we allow this? So those are the challenges. But what was happening now is to say Parliament needs to have a mechanism in place where it's saying to executives, before you sign any international agreement, inform Parliament the purpose of the international agreement, what will be the advantages to the country and the challenges of it, so that Parliament will be fully aware that there is this international agreement coming. Politically, that was going to be addressed. We said even if it can be part of the rules of Parliament, to say before you sign, inform Parliament and engage with Parliament. I'm coming to the issue of functioning of committees. In terms of the rules, this committee can function as a whole, all members as the mother committee. But there is nothing stopping the committee itself to form subcommittees. For instance, if this committee has a lot of work in terms of its program, it can form subcommittees and refer some of the issues to subcommittees. And those subcommittees, once they finalize whatever that the committee referred to, it reports to this committee so that the whole committee at the end of the day can report to the House. Some committees are using this. This is how even SCOPA operates, and it works for SCOPA because they have so many reports to consider. They form two subcommittees. They refer some of them to the two subcommittees. Once they are done with those reports, the whole committee consider them and take a position and decision in terms of how is it going to report on that. This committee can do that as well. The management committee. The management committees are committees that are formed by this committee in terms of managing the activities of this committee for the smooth running of this committee. Usually the membership to that committee is the chairperson, the whip of the committee, the support staff, as well as any other members, depending on this committee, whom are they going to appoint to be members of the management committee. Usually you find out there are three members of management committee. Those are the members that decide on the program of the committee, and when there are changes, what the committee need to do. But at the end of the day, whatever activity that they are doing, they report to the mother committee. It assists them because especially taking into account that program of Parliament changes now and again frequently, and it affects the program of committees. The conferral with other committees, it was mentioned here when Simelelo was making a presentation that the conferral that is meeting with other committees, how this committee will be able to do that. If we look at the fourth Parliament, we are saying that first Parliament is going to focus on oversight on service delivery and how that will happen. In some instances, we'll find that there will be a need for this committee to have a joint activities with other committees to be able to do that. And the rules of Parliament allows that. That says conferral with other committees. And even in terms of reporting, to say the committee can report jointly on some issues that affect, especially for issues that cut across committees that affect more than one committee. The issue of study groups, in terms of parliamentary program, we do have study groups. I'm not going to dwell on that because you're all aware that those are political meetings where members meet and discuss issues, sometimes issues referred to committees. I've already spoke about the closed meetings. I want to talk about participation of SALCA. I put a question mark there. SALCA is one of the, it's recognized in terms of the constitution. You'll find out a committee is discussing an issue that is going to have an impact to municipalities and all that stuff. At what stage will the committee invite SALCA to be part of those discussions? You are dealing, you are committee for rural development. Rural development mostly covers even rural areas, municipalities. What role can be played by SALCA when the committee is doing its work in some of the programs of the committee? Do you invite SALCA? If you invite SALCA, what will be the role of SALCA? That is the question mark I'm putting for this committee, take into account when it does its programming, its planning. The powers of the committee, in terms of the rules of Parliament, the committee has a prerogative to determine its own procedure. How is it going to function? But, of course, it's going to be guided by parliamentary program and the rules of Parliament. In terms of the rules and even in terms of the constitution, the committee can summon any person to appear before it to give evidence on oath or to produce documents. When you talk about this, this is the rule, this is the power, very strong power that a committee has. But in practice, how do you implement this power? Because I'm sure that is the question mark that members are having. Remember, we have rules and the Constitution. In terms of practicality, the first step, of course, will be for the committee to invite this person and write to this person. But if the person resists and doesn't want to come and appear before the committee, and then the committee will write to the presiding officer. It is the presiding officer, the speaker, in terms of the rules, that has the power to issue out summons on behalf of this committee for this person to be able to appear before the committee. I spoke about the issue of public participation to conduct oversight over the executive and to facilitate bills that are referred to them. I spoke about the issue of the quorum when I spoke before. A committee meeting can proceed irrespective of the number of members that attended the committee meeting. But it becomes an issue when a committee needs to take a decision if the committee doesn't have a quorum. And currently, the official number for members of a committee is 13. Then it means the quorum is 50 plus 1. That is 7 members for the committee to be able to take a decision. In some instances, you'll find out the committee doesn't have a quorum, but it needs to take a decision. And then the committee, the chairperson, can co-opt any member to come and take a decision. If the committee take a decision without having a quorum, that decision can be challenged and that decision can be declared null and void. So it means that there was no decision taken. So that's why it is crucial for the committee to have a quorum when it takes a decision. The co-option of members, I explained the co-option is when you don't have a quorum and the chairperson decide to co-opt some members to come and attend the meeting. But it has to be the members of the same house, that is the National Assembly, because this is a portfolio committee. Again, I put a question mark there to say to what extent can the chairperson co-opt members. For instance, if you want to adopt an item that is before the committee and your quorum is 7 and the members of the committee have only 2 members of the committee, can the committee co-opt 5 members to come and adopt the report? In terms of the rules are not specific to say to what extent can you co-opt. It can happen. But in reality, the practice is that it may have implications to the committee because those members that are adopting that particular report or whatever, they don't have an insight in terms of what is the content of that report. And if it's challenged at a later stage, the committee should be in a position to own up whatever issue that they adopted. Reporting, in terms of the rules of parliament, says that at least a committee should report once a year on its activities and on any matter that is referred to the committee by the House. So we find that when an issue is referred to a committee, we'll say it for consideration and report. So once it's said that, that committee is expected to report to the House. But in terms of the rules, at the end of the year, this committee is supposed to report and submit a report to the House for tabling, and that report can be debated in the House on its activities. Currently, what we are doing as committee section, we put together a report on activities of each committee, and those reports, we submit them to the House chairperson of committees. And then whether they are going to be debated in the House, the programming committee will take a decision on that. Chairpersons, I think I need to touch on political approval that a committee needs to get when it needs to do some of its activities. And I believe that in some instances, cases like this, they cause tension between staff and the members of the committee, especially when they want to do something and staff members are saying, I'm still waiting for the approval from the office of the chief whip or from the office of the House chairperson of committees. If a committee wants to sit during this time listed here, it needs the approval of the chief whip. Reason being, the chief whip is in charge of attendance of members in the House. So if committee is going to to meet during the plenary, or the committee is going to meet away from Parliament, or during constituency, during the time allocated for study group, and during caucus, it's either weekend or the committee wants to undertake local or international trips, the chief would need to approve that in all these instances. So when this happened, the committee secretary submitted an application to the chief for approval. Especially, I want to focus on bullet number two. On bullet number two, especially if committees go, even if it's a committee slot, but they are going to meet outside Parliament, we need the approval. Because in some instances, there are security risks depending where are you going to meet. And secondly, what is the agenda of the committee? Secondly, the issue when members, if anything can happen to members, accident whatsoever, when we submit the claims to the insurance whatsoever, they also want to check the approval, whether this meeting was approved. So it's crucial for committee when it meets outside to get that approval. The approval, again, by the House Chairperson of Committees, Honorable Bapela, in this instance, programs of committees. The committee put together their programs, and all the programs are submitted to the House Chairperson for his or her approval. And then any committee activity that falls outside that program, that approved program, we have to get a permission for it, for oversight and international trips. And for outside sponsorship, even the approval is not even done by the House Chairperson, it's done by the presiding officers for political reasons, because they are trying to look at the issues of conflict of interest when there's an outside sponsorship. And then they will give their go-ahead when they are satisfied that there's no conflict of interest, this is not going to have a bad impact to the image of the institution. Chairperson, there's a part of financial authorization. Once the political approval has been granted for any committee activity, usually any activity will need funding. It has financial implications. And then there's an application that is submitted that needs approval. But that one, it's meant to keep track in terms of the budget of the committee. How much has been utilized by the committee and how much is the balance? So that if the committee is going to run out of funds before the end of the financial year, should be in a position to request more funds. So that's why we need financial approval. It's just to keep track record in terms of expenditure of the committee. Chairperson, I think I need just to touch on legislation, because there will be bills that will be referred to this committee. What is the committee expected to do when there's a bill referred to it? And how are the bills referred to committees when they are tabled in Parliament? The bills that are coming to Parliament, they are coming through the Office of the Speaker for National Assembly and Office of the Chairperson for the NCOP. And once these bills are referred to Parliament, they are provisionally tagged. For instance, because it's state law advisors that are drafting the bills. Once they drafted the bills, they will say, we are proposing that this bill should follow Section 75 or a Section 76 procedure in terms of the Constitution. But once the bill is here in Parliament, we have a joint taking mechanism. The joint taking mechanism, the composition of the members of that committee is the Speaker, the presiding officers, the Speaker, the Chairperson of the NCOP, their deputies, and the Parliamentary Legal Advisors. Parliamentary legal advisors are there on advisory capacity. They look at the bill and then they take a final decision whether this bill should follow Section 75 or a Section 76. So the final taking of the bill is done internally in Parliament by the presiding officers being advised by the parliamentary law advisor. That means that the JTM, even if the state law advisor said this bill is a Section 75, in many instances, it comes up and say we disagree with the state law advisors, because we find out maybe this bill is a mixed bill. Some of the provisions cover Section 75 and some of the provisions cover Section 76. And then based on that, they will take a decision in terms of how this particular should be dealt with, this particular bill. But the presiding officers, what I'm trying to say is that they have a final say. In doing so, they also give provinces an opportunity to comment in that particular bill, because once a bill is tabled, it is sent immediately to the provinces so that the provinces are fully aware of themselves and can start to prepare to say that there is this piece of legislation coming. Before I can talk about any other bills, I want to talk about the Joint Rule 159 bill. In terms of the Joint Rules of Parliament, it allows the ministers, if they intend to introduce piece of legislation in Parliament, to submit a draft bill. That draft bill, it says this is what the department intends to do, this is how the bill is going to look like. But a JR 159 bill, it may change at a later stage. It's just saying to you, here is the bill. In terms of your planning as Parliament, take into account that there is this bill coming. But what has been advised for committees to say, you can invite the department to brief the committee on that particular bill, but don't conduct any public hearing until that bill is officially before Parliament, because JR 159 is not officially before Parliament, because they are still looking at that particular bill. Once they are done with it, they are going to introduce it formally before Parliament. There might be changes when that is done. That's why I was saying don't conduct any public hearings on it, because it may change when it's there. I just want to talk about the different processes that legislation follows when it's referred to committees in Parliament. We have bills that are considered in terms of Section 74 bills, Section 74 of the Constitution. Those are the bills that amend the Constitution. Any bill that amends the Constitution should be considered in terms of Section 74 of the Constitution. The procedure will differ depending which part of the Constitution is amended by that particular bill. For instance, some of the Section 74 bills, they are not referred to NCOP. Some of them are referred to NCOP. That's what I'm saying, depending on what part of the Constitution is being amended. For instance, if you are amending a bill amending a boundary of a province, that bill should be referred to the NCOP, and that particular province should participate fully and endorse that amendment. A Section 75 bill, it's a bill that addresses the national interest. That is always introduced at the National Assembly. It cannot be introduced in the NCOP in terms of our Constitution and the rules. The NCOP, any bill that is referred to Parliament, is considered by the National Assembly and the NCOP. And of course, committees facilitate consideration of that bill. It's happening here. The spade work is done by committees, and then once they are done, they report to the House, and the House will adopt the bill. They make the recommendation. Public participation is always part of the legislation process. The Section 76 addresses the provincial interest. The difference between Section 75 and Section 76 is that Section 76 is the only bill that can be introduced either at the National Assembly or at the NCOP. It will depend that particular minister, which house does he or she wants to introduce that bill. Then kicks in 6 week cycle. I wrote the 6 week cycle. The 6 week cycle, I just want to indicate that is the time given to NCOP to consider Section 76. Because Section 76, it affects the provincial interest. Therefore, provinces are given an opportunity to give their input in that particular bill. So the 6 week cycle, it says to NCOP, include the provinces, refer the bill to the provinces, give provinces an opportunity if they want to have public hearings so that they can give their input to Parliament. Here is the tricky part, the Section 76(1) and the Section 76(2) bill. In terms of the content, that bill doesn't have any difference. As I said before, the difference is in which house has the bill been introduced. A Section 76 bill that is introduced at the National Assembly, it is Section 76(1). It's tagged to Section 76(1) bill. But if it's introduced, if the NCOP is tagged Section 76(2) bill. The importance of to make the distinction between the two, it's when the two houses deadlock. Because it's a Section 76 bill, it has provincial interest. So the National Assembly will consider the bill, the committee can amend the bill and report on that bill. And once that bill is referred to NCOP, the NCOP has the same powers as NA. It can consider that bill and make amendments. And the provinces will make their proposal for amendments. But if it started at the NA, then it was referred to the NCOP. Once the NCOP is amended, it must refer back to NA because that's the house where it started. Now the challenge is, it's when the National Assembly rejects or disagrees with the amendment proposed made by the NCOP. And then in that instance, the mediation committee will be established in terms of the Constitution, Section 78. That mediation committee has equal number of members from NA and from NCOP. They will sit down and look at the bill, even the dispute where the disagreement is. Once that happens, if that process of mediation committee fails, then if the bill was introduced in the National Assembly can pass that bill with two-thirds majority, irrespective of the disagreement, if the mediation process fails. But if it's a Section 76, it was introduced in the NCOP, and the mediation process fails, that bill will lapse automatically. So now the tricky where it is that the executive is fully aware of this. That's why most of the bills, even if it's a Section 76, is introduced in the NA, so that if the mediation process fails, the NA can pass the bill with two-thirds majority. On Section 77 of the Constitution, it's all the bills that are dealing with money bills, they follow Section 77. And I just want to mention here, it's only the Minister for Finance that can introduce money bills. But this year, Parliament, the Act giving Parliament power to amend money bills has been passed. And I just want to mention here that currently there's a task team that has been put in place. The House Chairperson of Committees is the convener of that task team to look at that Act and see how can Parliament implement that Act and how soon can Parliament implement that Act that will allow them to amend the money bill. There are instances, as I said before, when the joint tagging mechanism will say this is a mixed bill. It has interest of the provinces, but at the same time it has national interest. So in such instances, it's either they take a decision to say let's refer this bill back to the department for department to split the bill. Or if it's an urgent bill, they just say to the committee, just consider these particular clauses that deals only with Section 75 and leave the others. So those are two options that they always do. But the committee usually is guided in terms of what needs to happen. So once a bill is referred to a committee, what is crucial for the committee, it should not report on that bill until the JTM pronounces itself on the taking of that bill. Because in terms of the rule, that bill is referred to JTM, but at the same time it's referred to the committee. And there's nothing stopping the committee to consider that bill. But before it reports, let's check what is the final tagging by JTM. There's a fast tracking of bills that usually becomes a challenge in terms of Parliament. A bill can be fast tracked in Parliament for various reasons, but there is a process that is followed. For instance, if the minister wants a bill to be fast-tracked in Parliament, that request is submitted through the Office of the Leader of Government Business, and there must be good reasons why the minister is saying the bill should be fast-tracked. And once that is approved, it means that the committee to where the bill has been referred, they need to put aside whatever activity that they were doing and deal with this bill. And it means that in some instances, when we are fast-tracking the bill, we are bending some of the rules of Parliament. Let me make an example. In terms of public participation, you find out you may not have extensive public participation. What you can do is just to invite written submissions and you look at the written submissions because of the urgency of the bill. There are bills that are also prioritized. The prioritized bills, the difference is that they are not fast-tracked. But what Parliament is saying, this bill is the priority. Now that it is a priority, we are going to follow all the processes. We are not going to bend anything, but everything else must stand aside and let Parliament deal with this legislation and finish it. That's what they are saying. In summary, what I'm saying is that committees, they have, in terms of the Constitution and rules of Parliament, they have these options when they are dealing with a bill. It's either they adopt the bill as it is without amending it, they can amend the bill, they can reject a bill. If I can remember, during the third Parliament, I believe there were three bills that were rejected by committees. They were referred to committees, they look at them, they have different reasons why they rejected the bill, but a committee can reject a bill. Or if the bill is before the committee and the committee cannot finalize that bill and it's towards the end of the term, of the parliamentary term, that bill, committee can allow that bill to lapse and it can be revived by the next parliament. And there's also the withdrawal of a bill. The minister, as a person who introduced the bill, the minister can also withdraw that bill for whatever decisions. But I'm sure that will be discussed with that particular committee and the speaker. But if the bill, if this bill was introduced at the National Assembly and the National Assembly has finalized the bill, now the bill is already with the NOP. It cannot be withdrawn at that stage. It should be withdrawn when it's still with the First House. Chairperson, I think I need I put the issue of the deadlines for the committee so that you understand when you deal with legislation that there are deadlines that are set for committees to finalize a particular bill or any matter, by the way, that is referred before the committee. Because Parliament sets itself deadlines and gives these deadlines to the executive to say, if the executive, for instance, you introduce your bill by February this year, as Parliament, we make an undertaking saying that by August, all those bills will be done. So what it means that if the bill is referred here, we need to guide the committee in terms of saying these are the deadlines, the committee should finalize this bill by this particular time. But if the committee cannot do that, it can ask for extension from the House Chairperson, through the House Chairperson, to the Programming Committee to be given more time depending on the nature of the bill before the committee. At a committee stage, this is what the committees are doing when they are considering bills. Number one, they get the briefing from the department. Secondly, depending on the nature of the bill, if it's a very controversial bill, a committee can decide to say, let's have a workshop. Let's workshop this bill so that they can get a full understanding of what the bill is all about and then facilitate public participation through the public hearings. Then they deliberate on input from the public hearings, consider the bill clause by clause and make the amendments, and then at the end they are going to adopt the bill, especially the amended version of the bill. What we advise committees to say after they've done the amendments and the staff went back and put those amendments in a bill, it's very important for the committee to come back to adopt the final version of the bill with the amendments, so that it can satisfy itself that this is what we agreed on and not just see the bill in the House. The last time they saw it is when they were proposing amendments. the last version of the bill is crucial for them to adopt it. I would like to mention the issue of challenges, Chairperson. Sometimes there are challenges for committees to be able to do their work. I think we need to raise that up front. The lack of resources financially, committees are given a budget. For instance, the budget given to this committee for this financial year is 450,000 rand for the committee to be able to do its work. But whether that money is enough or not, it's a question mark. I'm sure members will be asking, how can you dictate to us and give us 450,000? There are processes that are followed there in terms of Parliament getting its budget and how much is allocated to the committee. And in some instances, we also have challenges when it comes to human resources. But at least now, we had challenges at the beginning of the year. Money has been given to us. For instance, I'm aware that the chairperson of this committee doesn't have a secretary, but we just finalized the recruitment for filling of vacancies, and then the secretary will be allocated. In some instances, we'll find out we have challenges where the committee secretary will go on maternity leave, and then we have to get someone to replace that committee secretary, and that person will be there for 4 months. And sometimes it raises misunderstanding between management and the members of the committee because that person will be new, not fully understanding in terms of what was happening, but we try and assist them. The frequent changes on parliamentary program, it becomes a nightmare for committees to do their work. On a weekly basis, there is a program committee meeting on Thursdays at 8:30. In that meeting, that's where the program of Parliament is discussed for National Assembly and for NCOP it's Wednesday. There are changes that are made now and again in the program of or in those meetings, and some of the decisions and changes made there, they impact the programs of committees. And we find out committees are not able to do their work. And currently, I've been saying, for instance, currently, this committee can meet only once a week. It has, in terms of the schedule and term allocated to committees. You meet once a week, it's only in the morning. Let's say the maximum time you can meet is 4 hours. And in the afternoon is plenary and everything else. The work of committees and the, even the issues referred to committees, matters referred to committees by the presiding officers, committees are expected to report on this particular time, doesn't talk to the time allocated to committees. But we also raised that with the House Chairperson and we submitted our concerns from our side and the House Chairperson was going to discuss, have a workshop with the Chairperson to look at those issues. But the frequent changes in parliamentary program has a great impact in terms of the manner in which committees are operating. I will say on that note, thank you, Chairperson, on rules of committees.
Thank you, Ms. Mene. And before ANC members, we are requested to, we have these forms in our packs. So we are requested to fill them in and submit them. Because if we leave with them to our offices, they'll disappear there. I know mine will disappear. So members are requested to fill these forms in and hand them in as a matter of urgency. And the second issue is on the issue of the rules. We have rules of parliament, and I'm not sure if members are aware that on the packs that we're giving the new members, on the files that we're given when we came to parliament, the rules are there, the joint rules and all those other things. But I know some of us don't even refer back to those files because they are so big and you have a lot of work to do. But it will be proper for us to, from time to time, page on those files to check the rules, what is happening, what is it that we can do as members. And thank you, Ms. Mene. Okay. And she has another presentation that she's supposed to do on oversight and accountability. And we'd like to also welcome Professor Ben Cousins. You're welcome, sir, to the committee. And I hope you'll find it very interesting because members are very eager to learn. Most especially, I think, on your topic, I'm one of those that are very interested. Thank you. Ms. Mene, can you continue?
Thank you, Chairperson. My next presentation is on oversight model. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm sorry, I'm technologically challenged. My colleague is trying to assist me. Chairperson, my presentation is going to be on oversight model of Parliament and accountability. I must say upfront, Chairperson, the document is there, but it's not been implemented yet for various reasons. I'm going to mention while I'm doing my presentation, but the model is there. My presentation, Chairperson, what I'll try to do is to summarize the model chapter by chapter so that to give the members a full understanding what the oversight model covers and at the same time what are the challenges currently that led to the model not to be implemented yet. I'll start, Chairperson, by saying constitutionally, Parliament, it has a responsibility to conduct oversight over the executive. Parliament has been doing oversight. I want to say it up front. It has been doing oversight since 1994, after the first general elections. But the challenge that Parliament is having is to say that this oversight is not coordinated. It's done on ad hoc basis. Each committee is doing its own thing, and the House is doing its own thing. No board, there's no central point where to coordinate oversight. And at the same time, it was also identified that some of the challenges is the duplication of the oversight activities that were done by committees. I will give an example to find out the committee of the National Assembly will visit Eastern Cape this week. The same week, the committee of the NSOP visit the same province, the same venue, for the same purpose. So those are the challenges that Parliament identified when it was conducting its own oversight. And then based on that, they took a decision that they need to come up with a model as Parliament to say, how effective can Parliament be to conduct its oversight? And this exercise started as far as 1998, but the model was only adopted in 2008 on the 19th of March. And there was a lot of consultation that was done when Parliament was doing the oversight. And in 2004, the third Parliament has a vision and a mission. And one of the strategic objectives of that vision and mission was to have an effective and efficient oversight as Parliament. That was to enhance the idea of saying, let's have an oversight model that is going to guide us as Parliament politically how to conduct oversight. The very same model, it provides Parliament with the oversight tool that Parliament can use. And at the same time, that can be used by committees on behalf of Parliament when it conducts oversight. That is SONA. SONA stands for State of the Nation Address. That is one of the tools that can be used by Parliament, because at the beginning of the year, we are all aware that the President of the country makes the State of the Nation Address, and in that address, it indicates what are the priorities of the government for that particular year. Therefore, Parliament has to monitor and ensure that those programs are implemented. There are annual reports from the departments in terms of Public Finance Management Act that are supposed to be tabled by departments by the end of September. Even now at the end of September, we are waiting for those annual reports that are going to indicate the performance of departments. We also have annual reports from Chapter 9 institutions. Those are the institutions that support our democracy that can also assist Parliament to conduct oversight. And those are more reliable reports because those are independent institutions. They do their own assessment and they report to Parliament. What Parliament has established is that when these reports are tabled, in reality they were never considered by Parliament formally and used the recommendation in those reports. And we have a budget speech, we have budget votes that are referred to Parliament, to committees as well. How can Parliament use all this information to conduct effective oversight? As I said before, current practice is that Parliament do conduct oversight, but it was not in a coordinated fashion. I will start by Chapter 1 in terms of analyzing the oversight model. The Chapter 1 deals only with the vision and mission of Parliament, because it was during the third Parliament. We are not sure whether the fourth Parliament is going to continue and adopt the same vision and mission, but politically, I believe the Office of the Speaker and the chairperson of the NSOP, they are looking at that, whether they keep the current vision or Parliament will have another vision for fourth Parliament. But it's about the definition, and it also argues that Parliament has a responsibility to fulfill its mandate of oversight. That is only Chapter 1, giving an overview of what Parliament's responsibility is and the different definitions. Chapter 2, it also expands on definitions. And what it emphasizes on, Chapter 2, is about saying, what is the role of Parliament? How can Parliament assert itself to conduct oversight? That is the crucial part. Because Parliament, if we can speak, is one of the three arms of government. We have judiciary, we have executive, and then we have legislature, which is Parliament. But if you go outside, you speak to members of the public or to ordinary people, Parliament doesn't feature. They don't fully understand what is the role of Parliament. For them, Parliament and executive is one and the same. It doesn't make any difference to them. And then Parliament is saying it's high time that we will market ourselves, if I can put it like that. Let us be known. And when we are known, we are not going just to market Parliament. We should be known about the role that Parliament is playing in terms of oversight, in terms of its constitutional mandate. The challenge that also Parliament identified was the challenge that if Parliament is going to assert itself and have effective and efficient oversight, what are the challenges? And it came out that one of the challenges may be the resistance from the executive side, because the oversight in some instances will be exposing some of the failures of the department for them to implement the policies of the government and in terms of service delivery. That has been identified as one of the challenges. Chapter 3 also is to defeat this, there is this notion that Parliament is not effective. Parliament is useless. I think one of the questions that was asked by the Honourable Member was to say, what power does Parliament have to ensure that recommendations made by Parliament can be implemented? Then the oversight model is trying to address those issues. Because currently, in terms of the rules of Parliament, the committee, I'll make an example, you go and conduct oversight, you have your fact findings, you find out that there are challenges in this area, you come back and write a report. Once that report is debated in the House adopts the report. The recommendations become resolutions of Parliament. And those resolutions, the Office of the Speaker write to the relevant department and say these are the resolutions of Parliament in terms of the challenges that have been identified by Parliament. But the challenge with that system that is in place is that it's only the resolution. There is no mechanism we can force the department to implement those resolutions. One, some of the issues that are raised is that departments are allocated budget. You'll find out the issue that you've been raising now, the department did not include it in its program for this financial year. It is part of the program, let's say, for the next financial year. So there are no funds available at that particular time to address that particular issue. So those are some of the reasons that are provided by the executive when you make a follow-up when the issue was not implemented. But in some areas, yes, there are challenges. Even if there are funds available, some of the recommendations are not implemented. Now, how can Parliament make sure that their recommendations are in place? The oversight model, one of its aspects is to come up with a tracking and monitoring mechanism. And there is a proposal that this mechanism should reside in the offices of the presiding officer. The other issue that we identified is to say that, as I said before, Parliament is one of the three arms of government. But when it comes to funding, the budget allocated to Parliament, Parliament is not on the same par with the executive and at the same time with the judiciary. Yes, of course, we can't expect them to get the same budget as them because the executive, it implements, that needs a lot of money and everything. But let me take an example and say the funding allocated to Parliament, it's also one of the constraints that makes Parliament not to have an effective oversight, because oversight demands a lot of money. If you are going to go and visit the communities and meet with the communities and check what is happening, you need money to be able to do that. One of the challenges in terms of budget allocation to the three arms of government, you find out for the executive, the salaries and the packages of ministries, they don't form part of the budget that is allocated to the department. But the budget that is allocated to Parliament, before Parliament does anything, it must take out the salaries of members and the benefits of members, and then whatever is left, Parliament will do its work. Even for the judiciary, the salaries of judges, they are not part of the budget of the Justice Department. But for Parliament, it goes that way. Is that the right way? Those are the areas that the oversight model tries to address. Adding the Financial Management Act of Parliament is one of the issues that it tries to address. The oversight model, it also established a joint parliamentary oversight and government assurance committee. This committee will oversee the implementation of oversight for each house, and each house will have its own substructure. And what is the challenge here? I want to raise aside why the oversight model is not implemented yet. They are still looking at it politically. Is that this joint parliamentary oversight and governance assurance committee, they are saying it's going to be responsible to manage and oversee oversight conducted by committees, and that is done by Parliament, especially on issues that are transversal and cross-cutting issues. The challenge here is that currently we have structures that are in place. We have the Office of the Chief Whip that has a role that is placed. We have the Office of the House Chairperson of Committees for both houses. We also have the role of the chairpersons and the committees, that they have powers to decide their own program, how they are going to conduct their own oversight and everything else. Now what we need is the clarity and the role clarification in terms of saying if this committee is going to be established, because it looks like it's going to be a super committee, how is it going to relate with other committees? And at the same time, how is it going to relate with the existing political structures that are in place that are responsible for oversight? So we need to have clarity on that before we implement that to avoid conflict and duplication of roles. And at the same time, the oversight is creating advisory section. And its proposal, it proposes that this advisory section should be should reside at the offices of the presiding officer. Even there, the question that has been asked is to say, currently within the administration of Parliament, some of the work is done in different sections. Are we saying that we're taking away those functions and we're putting this section together? Or are we saying, let's augment what is happening in those sections? So those are the areas that we need guidance politically to say how this should be implemented. I mentioned the issue of the super committee, the committee they want to establish. This is the role of the political office bearers and the advisory section. The Chapter 5 of the oversight was referring to it was still a bill then, that gives Parliament power to amend many bills. As I said before, that is an act now, and there's a task team working together with this one of implementing the oversight to say how can Parliament implement the act to amend many bills. That is Chapter 5 of the oversight. Chapter 6 is about coordination. As I said before, Chapter 6 of the oversight model is saying how can we ensure that Parliament has coordinated oversight. I will start by saying oversight in Parliament is done in terms of the two houses. There's an oversight that is happening in the House through questions, motions, statements, and there's an oversight that is done by committees. Now, oversight done by committees, especially committees, how do we coordinate that oversight? If you are speaking about a committee on rural development, what are other committees affected by the issues that this committee deals with? For instance, the Committee on Local Traditional and Provincial and Local Government, this new committee. This work of this committee, how does it affect the work of that committee? Some of the issues they overlap. So we need to have a coordinated approach when these committees are working in some of those issues, especially when they want to conduct oversight. If I can be frank, I'll give an example. I think it was a committee of the NCOP and committee of the National Assembly. They go and conduct oversight. It was so embarrassing for Parliament. They arrive at this place at a different time, same day, for the same purpose. So those are the challenges that Parliament is having. And provinces are complaining because now it looks like Parliament goes there. It doesn't even inform them that we are coming to the province. And some of the issues that are raised, they'll find out the province is addressing those issues. So those are the challenges. That's why Parliament is saying, let's have a coordinated approach, starting at a committee level when they conduct oversight. You'll find out in some instances when the committee applies, now the chairperson is applying that immediately now, even before the oversight is implemented, to say, if you are going to do oversight on this, he looks at the purpose of that trip, if you want to go, and say, well, how about conferring with this other committee if you want to do this? The House Chairperson is already starting to do that. Chapter 7, it talks about, we have this oversight model. If Parliament wants to implement this oversight model, we need to look at the issue of capacity. From the administration point of view, to support staff to Parliament have the necessary capacity to assist members to implement the oversight model. And at the same time, we need to look at the members' point of view. To members, because members should be taken through the oversight model, because it means that it's going to change the manner in which Parliament works and the manner in which committees operate. Because if we talk about coordinated oversight, if we talk about coordinated approach in terms of doing oversight to tech service delivery, start at planning level. If committees are planning, they need to plan together, some of them, so that this thing can happen smoothly. That is what Chapter 7 is all about. Chapter 8, Chapter 10 is talking about the best practice guide. It says that there should be a best practice guide. This best practice guide will guide the committees in terms of how can they conduct oversight, but at the same time, learning from experiences of the previous parliament, second parliament and third parliament, and take those experiences and see whether they can work now or where can parliament improve. And chapter 9 is talking about the audit of public bodies and their accountability. It has been established that there are public bodies or public entities that are using public funds, but they don't report to Parliament in terms of what is their outcome and how those funds are used. So oversight model gives an instruction to say, let's audit each and every public entity that is using public funds. And at the same time, if we are saying all those public entities are going to report to Parliament, how is Parliament going to consider those reports and use that information effectively? That's what Chapter 9 is all about. In conclusion, Chairperson, the conclusion is saying even the oversight model, it's going to be a document that will be flexible. I would say it's an evolving process because Parliament is starting to realize now that we need to assert ourselves, we need to do oversight effectively, and then there will be changes as the time goes on. Currently, we can say that this is the best manner to do that, but oversight model is not going to be cast in stone. It can be changed when it's necessary. That's what the conclusion is saying. What is the meaning of oversight to Parliament? Politically, I would say it means that there will be a need for mind shift, the manner in which things are done. Because currently we find out each committee has its own program and does things its own way. But if we are going to implement oversight, we need to change that approach. and participation of members to understand their role. What is the role of members of parliament? How can they play their role to make sure that parliament does its work accordingly? And at the same time, it means that when we need to establish the committee that has been mentioned in Chapter 4 and we clarify the roles between the existing political office thereof and the current administration, we also need to enhance the support in the offices of political office thereof if we are saying oversight model should be implemented. Administratively, the staff that is supporting members of parliament, they also need to have a mind shift to say that this is the new way in which things are going to happen in parliament. Are we ready to support members so that members are not on this page and staff is on another page? The model is also saying that administratively we need to review the support we provide to members. And in which manner are we going to provide that support? Do we need the sections that are referring to oversight model, or the current staff should review what kind of support they are providing to members? And at the same time, we need to put systems in place to make sure that the oversight model is implemented whenever it's ready. The risk for oversight model, if we can look at the risk to say what can make the model not to be implemented successfully, is reluctance to change from staff. You know, it's very difficult to change. When you've been used doing things this way, you become comfortable. That happens. It's a human nature. We need to change that. And the lack of understanding of the model. If we don't fully understand what are the objectives of the model and what Parliament is trying to achieve, of course, we won't be able to implement that model. Assets here, with due respect, Chairperson, lack of commitment, political and administrative. If we're not committed to implement the model, of course the model will fail. And lack of resources, Chairperson. I mentioned the parliamentary program as well, because if we are going to implement the oversight model, it means that the manner in which parliamentary program is done should be reviewed. On that note, thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Ms. Mene. I think members who have questions have noted them and would like in this regard to request Professor Cousins to come forward and give us a presentation. Okay, members. I'm sorry, my apologies for this. I'm informed that Ms. Mene is going to another meeting now. Can we just give ourselves an opportunity of interacting with her presentation and then we release her? Thank you. Members with questions, can you raise your hands? Can I start from this side? Prince and Honorable Mabila, Honorable Swate, Honorable Balindela, Honorable Nchaveling, and at the end is Honorable Kebekul. Oh, Simang, Professor Simang. I'm sorry, I'm learning to be on this chair, and it's going to be difficult for me to recognize all the names in that line.
Thank you, Chair. I think we have a problem regarding the budget for the committee. I think it's too small to assist the committee to do our oversight. I don't think we'll be able to fulfill the duty of this committee. Another thing, when we are talking about a rural development portfolio, it's a new portfolio, and the people are expecting more from this committee, especially in the rural, thinking that now there is the right department to deliver in the rural. But what I understand is that this department is a catalyst for other departments. It means that it is not that maybe I'm expecting that the department must do when we go out, because I will go there, do our oversight. People, they know what they want. They are not expecting us just to come and visit them and say we are going to do the oversight only. They are expecting us to come to them and deliver. But we are not going to do that. We'll go there and go to another department. Let's say I'm going to Madiba's ward area, tribal area, and then they know that they want dam, they want road, they want this and this. Now this department now comes to them and say, this is a rural development, we are coming to hear what you want. They telling us the very same thing that has been raising for years and years. Then we are leaving them, going to another department. We have no power to implement, to say, okay, we are here. We have the budget. We are going to, at least we are going to build this dam. We are going to supply water. I don't understand really. I find that the department is a duplication of the other department, which is not maybe going to fulfill what... I'm just confused, really. Maybe I need a clarity on this. Thank you.
Chairperson, the first one is a comment on the model whereby Mrs. Vanelli told us about the model, that the tools that you can use to conduct oversight. Yes, because you talk of the SONA, the annual report. I think also the strategic plans and the operational plans can play a very important role, because you can't consider the annual report without considering the operational plan and also the strategic plan of the department. Another thing that we have highlighted is the issue of the tracking of the resolution. You know, if you can take the committee report from 1994 up to date, you find a situation whereby there are two or three resolutions that have been taken from 1994 up to date, but they were not even implemented. You know, I think the weakness, we have identified the weakness of tracking the resolutions of whether resolutions are being implemented by the departments or not. Then the other one is on the first document that you shared with us. The first one is on the issue of the committee meetings, then in brackets, and set those meetings. Can you relate that to Section 59 of the Constitution, and also Section 72 and Section 118? Then the other one is on the oversight in international trips. Here, I just want to get the clarity. How many oversight international trips a committee is expected to have in a financial year? Then maybe also give some highlights on the time frame for approvals and disapprovals by the chief whip or by the house chair. Then the other thing that I wanted to highlight on is on the issue of the budget allocated to committees, as indicated by the honorable member there, that when when the allocation for the budgets are being, the allocation of budgets to committees are being made, is it the one size fits all, or maybe the business plan or the strategic plans of the committees are taken into account? Because I think committees have got different activities. If committees have got different activities, I don't think that their budget should just be the same. On the issue of the cycles, we talk of the six-week cycle, the other one, I think it was also another, whether it's a six-week cycle again. But do you think that if the executive or parliament adheres to those cycles, is there a need for the bill to be fast-tracked? Because I think we'll have enough time to follow the processes that are supposed to be followed from the introduction of the bill until the passing of the bill. Then the last one is the issue of the public participation. Do we have a public participation unit in the National Assembly? And also, if the answer is yes, the budget of the public participation for the committee, is it located in the committee budget or in the public participation unit budget, so that at the end of the day we're clear whether do we have that unit, what role is that unit playing with regards to the public participation issues? Because the understanding or the experience that I'm having is that our public hearings at the end of the day, they become the public education instead of being public hearings. So can I just declare then the truth? Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. I also have several questions to actually seeking clarity. My first question is actually with regard to the international agreement, as indicated that Parliament is actually just rubber stamping. So I just wanted to find out, is it us from the committee that can try maybe to change that Parliament could be actually heard? Can we do it from our committee, or can we do it from somewhere? I just wanted to find out what can we do so that the Parliament can actually be given teeth, or actually to participate fully, not just to be rubber stamp. And my second one is with regard to the super committee that you mentioned. You talked of that there is a need to have a super committee. So I just want to know, is that super committee going to actually formed by all follow committees, or are only going to be specific people, maybe from the executive, or not the executive, but from parliament that are actually going to lead that super committee? So I just want clarity in that regard. And another one is with regard to to finance. You also indicated that the budget of the parliament and the budget of judiciary and budget of executive is not on the same level, and that's why parliament can't even do some of its duties. So I just want to find out, is there anything that's going to be done? Because we just passed a money bill that the parliament is going to also to participate to have a say in financial matters. Is that not going to address that, so that we are on at an equal footing with other arms of government? And the other one is with regard to the quorum. You also indicated that for a decision to be taken in a portfolio committee, there must be a quorum. If we can't make a quorum, then the decision could be challenged. So I just want to find out if that decision could be challenged by the person who is being summoned to come to account to the committee, or will that come from court if the person takes us to court with regard to that? Yeah, I think that that's all from my side. Thank you. Bye.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to quickly say, can't the department, let me put it this way, the presentations that have been made here today are presentations, including the gentleman's presentation, are presentations that every member of parliament is supposed to hear. And therefore, there are presentations that I don't know whether it's possible for the team here to then go and present these to our other departments. I'm in finance also, and finance needs to hear this. I'm also an alternate in my major is home affairs. They need to hear this presentation. So is there a way that a process can be started? Everybody needs to hear this presentation because it's a very beautiful presentation. It brings back, it is saying to us, your powers have now all been taken by executive. And it is trying to say we are now bringing back your powers as parliament. Second one is also, and Madam Chair, just talking about these powers that are no longer there, that make the parliament to be so toothless, look at the tracking of the resolutions for so many years. I am sure if we could track all those resolutions, we would realize that we are really toothless. So the second one is now that there is a planning commission in government, because I understand why suddenly we are together, and then a few people are now given back to manage government. And then those people are so vastly different from us, because sometimes we are supposed to really say to the MECs and the premiers and the ministers that things are supposed to go like this. What is it that makes us now lose that power once they are in government? And Madam Chair, I'm saying this from experience, because I remember how many times, if you are really interested in Parliament, you would even bring the attention of some of the things that are happening to the members of Parliament, yourself as a leader there in government. So I'm saying then there's a National Planning Commission. How about it hearing what Usi Sanele and the gentleman presented today? And maybe we find a way of doing our monitoring and evaluation based on this very good exercise. Engos.
Thank you very much, Chair. And you mentioned that you are struggling to remember names, but in my case, I don't think it's your fault. Unfortunately, I've not been regular here because of attending other committees that meet at the same time. But I'm very grateful that I attended this one, because the agenda is very crucial, as the speaker before me has just emphasized, that all committees need to hear what we are hearing today. I've got just two questions. When Ms. Mene first made her first presentation, she touched on the attempts to achieve a quorum by co-option. And she put a question mark there because it's not entirely satisfactory. I agree fully with her that you cannot co-opt somebody who hasn't got background knowledge and context of what you're dealing with to simply come and rubber stamp. Now I'm asking whether the rules, and it's my shortfall again that since May I've been here and I haven't started the rules, don't they make other provisions of achieving a quorum? Because this one, indeed, I agree with her, is not satisfactory. If there was perhaps some postponement to say, okay, we'll emphasize to people that next time is the D-date, we want to take these resolutions, and they have to attend. But to go out and cohort is not satisfactory. And then coming to the latter presentation, I think it's a very crucial, especially on the point which she kept emphasizing, the point of coordination. As we, as most of us are serving on a number of different committees, you experience that all of them are grappling with the drawing of their strategic plan. And each one is approaching the subject differently. And I think it would really be beneficial to us if the copies of this model could be made available, because then we could emphasize in other portfolio committees where we are serving, where perhaps they haven't been this fortunate to have the presentation made. We could emphasize to them the significance of coordination. The Honorable Prince mentioned that our committee cuts across other portfolio committees. You go there and people say to you they need water, but you have to go to the Department of Water. If we are coordinated, I think it will accelerate service delivery. Thank you.
Honorable Chabeni.
Thanks, Chairperson. There was mention, I think twice earlier, the abbreviation that says FABLA. I don't know what that means, and I just hope it's not the FABLA I know. Christopher, I'm thinking about this, the 450,000 rand for the committee budget. It's not on. I mean, looking at the, it was just a rural development and land reform committee. We're dealing with the most vulnerable in our communities. You're talking about people who get rejected by certain areas. You know, when people get older, the urban areas download them to the rural areas. If you get disabled, you know, the only solace you get is going back to the land of your ancestors, you know, preparing to join them later, maybe. And, yeah, it's the disabled, the aged, and, I mean, all of them most vulnerable. And with this 450, how many villages will we be able to visit? Because, you see, when people see members of parliament, we bring hope to them. And they feel that now that we are not listened to by local government, and possibly the provincial government is not responding to our... But when people come from Cape Town, it's like, oh, we're going to... Big Brother is here, you know. We're not going to be able to do with this 450. And we are the only hope that these people have, except the lottery for those who can travel to a shop and buy a lotto ticket. Because that is the only hope that people have. And there was talk about the international agreements. Can we have a list of agreements and details that pertain to our committee, so that we know that in Brazil there is this agreement with South Africa on rural development and land. These are the agreements. And then there was again mention of the African peer review mechanism. What are those things in the African peer review mechanism that affect or are touching our committee? Thanks, Chairman.
Okay, Honorable Hangan.
Perhaps an understanding from us members. We're politicians, number one, firstly. We're politicians, and each and every party does not function as the other party. We function differently. In terms of the bills, that work is done by your party in your caucus. That's where you get a thorough political briefing and what political implications there are around issues. Specific bill. In terms of the co-option here, I'll give you a lovely example. When we passed the pregnancy termination bill, the termination of pregnancy bill,
some of us were co-opted onto that portfolio committee because there was no forum. It doesn't mean a permanent co-option. It means a temporary co-option, particularly when you're going to vote on that particular bill. And that direction also comes from your very party. What does your party say about that particular bill that you will be voting on to? So it's just those conceptions that I wanted to verify, that the parties operate differently. Now, in my party where I come from, I deal with bills in a caucus. We get a thorough briefing in the caucus, explain the bill, political implications as well. Thank you.
Thank you, members. I would like to respond to one part of Honorable Balindela's first input. I think it's good that this committee has embarked on this process, and we are not in a position to say to other committees, they go the way that we went. It's for members that are in that committee to give guidance to say, no, this is what we have experienced on this portfolio committee. Can we go the same route? It will depend on that committee. Can I hand over to Ms. Mene?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll try to respond to all the questions. The first question was around the issue of budget allocated to committees. Yes, each committee is allocated 450,000 budget for this financial year. I want to say it up front, it has been acknowledged that the 450 is inefficient for committees to do their work effectively. And when we submit the budget, because this is the first year immediately after the general elections, and there were new ministers that were established, and there were new committees like this one that were established because of that development at the executive level. So initially committees were going to get plus minus 800,000 per committee, but because now there are new extra committees, six extra committees, so that money was supposed to be given to those committees as well. Yes, previously the approach was a blanket approach. Each committee were given equal amount of budget irrespective of the workload. And the reason was being is that committees were not doing a spread plan and submit their business plan so that there can be a guide in terms of the work that that particular committee intends to do. So that's why there was a blanket in terms of allocating funds. But if you look at this fourth parliament, I think the approach has changed. Committees have been requested to submit their strat plan or five-year program. And looking at that, they are going to be costed. And they need to be looked at to see how much each committee may get for the next financial year. But because the budget cycle has already started, what the House chairpersons have done, their submission to the budget forum was to say, can we have, at least as a baseline, let's have $1 million for each committee, and then there will be a pool that will be put together for committees that will exhaust that $1 million, because committees, it was just immediately after the elections, and the process have already started in terms of the budget. And then they also requested to have a pool of plus minus 12 million, and that pool will be used for unforeseeable circumstances. For instance, if your committee's program is going to exhaust its budget, and then that there will be money that will be available to allocate to committees that will need extra money for them to be able to do their work. And one of the issues that has been identified is that you find out if a committee wants to facilitate public participation, public hearings, you want to send out adverts, you want to do radio announcements, those are very expensive. Because currently we are trying to look at cost-effective manners in which of engaging in public participation. So we're also wanting to, we also said to the House Chairperson, how about having money that is going to look at those issues? For instance, the publication, if the committee want to have this, if we're going to have address, let's not use the budget of the committee. Let's have a separate budget, because that's what it's mostly in terms of the budget of committees. So what I'm saying is that in principle it has been acknowledged that the money is not enough, but it was because there was no proper time for committees to plan and indicate how much will be needed for committees. But I hope that for the next financial year, more funds will be allocated to committees to be able to do their work. The other thing that was a challenge for committees was to say, when we go there, we go with, as Parliament, and even as Parliament within, there are other, I will say, issues, or there are competence, there are competing interests within even Parliament in terms of its budget. And there's committees, there is a political parties, there's money allocated to political parties, there's money for administration and all that stuff. So we have to go to the budget forum and present the budget and defend the budget. And what has been coming up strictly was to say, they referred the previous committees to say that committees were allocated money, but committees couldn't spend their money. But what we're saying is to say, committees couldn't spend their money because there was no time allocated to committees in terms of parliamentary program for them to spend the money. But committees do have programs that will allow them to use their budget. So what we are saying, that when we said even to the House Chairperson, let's review the parliamentary program because it has an impact in the manner in which committees work. And at the same time, now it spills over to the funds that are allocated to committees. On the issue of the Department of Rural Development being a catalyst, I would say I agree fully with you. That's where the issue of coordinated approach comes in. Because what we are saying, if the committee intends to go, let's say, to Tofimbaba in Eastern Cape, let us have a research to say what are the challenges in Tofimbaba. There's a challenge, let's say, of electricity, there's a challenge of water, there's a challenge of sanitation, whatsoever. So that when the committee goes there, they are fully aware what are the challenges there. And at the same time, you even before you go there, you contact the relevant departments to check what is happening there. If they are saying that they don't have water, what are the plans of the department for water and all that stuff? That is the coordinated approach that we're talking about. Again, applying the principle of cooperative governance within the spheres of government. On the issue of oversight, tracking mechanism, there's a question raised. Yes, it is a weakness, Honorable Member, that has been identified, and Parliament is trying to look at that. Even currently, we have an office where we're saying, let's try and track all the resolutions that has been made, has been submitted to executive, and the process and the pace of implementing those resolutions. In terms of committee meetings are held in closed meetings of committee meetings, and the Honorable Member referred me to Section 59, 72, and 118 of the Constitution, which is talking about public access in terms of the committee meetings and the sittings of Parliament. Yes, Member, that is a constitutional obligation, but at the same time, if you look at Section 36 of the Constitution, it also limits that right, because it's saying it is a right, but there's a limitation clause for each and every right that is there, even for Bill of Rights, as long as that limitation is done for valid reasons in an open democracy. So that's what is happening. But committees, for them to take that decision, they must have a reason to do that. That's why we are saying you cannot just do it. You must have a very good reason. The time frame that has been raised in terms of approving by the House Chairperson of Committees and the Chief Whip, I would say it depends at what, when is the application submitted to those offices. For instance, if this committee decides today that we want to do ABCD and the application is submitted to Honorable Bapela, we make a follow-up. That office doesn't take more than 2 days to approve any
request that is submitted to that office unless the chairperson has reservations. And what we said to the chairperson, once he has reservations about an application, I think the chairperson should contact the particular chairperson to discuss those reservations with the chairperson. And even from our side, we give an update to the chairperson how far is the application. And when it comes to the issue of the chief whip for office, it also happens like that. But the challenge in that office sometimes is the availability of the chief whip. It depends when has the application been submitted there. The six-week cycle, a member asked whether do we need to fast-track a bill if we have a six-week cycle. Yes, there are instances where there are reasons to fast-track the bill even if we have a six-week cycle, because the six-week cycle is used as a guide. In some instances, depending on the nature of the bill, we find out Parliament will need more than 6 weeks to deal with that bill. So that's when the issue of the... I'll make an example, the bill that dealt with the termination of pregnancy that the Honourable referred to. The six-week cycle was never enough. I can mention even the bill that deals with the civil union bill. The 6 week was not enough. The DSO bill, when the Scorpions were disbanded, the 6 week was not enough. So it depends on the nature of the bill that is before Parliament. That's when the decision is taken about fast track.
Honourable members, I realize that we don't have enough time and we still have a presentation by the professor, and I think that is also very important. I was proposing that we release Ms. Mene, and then we give her another date where she can come and finalize our responses. But we hand over now to Professor Cousins to come in. Or maybe she can respond in writing to all the questions that were posed by members. Then we hand over to Professor Cousins to come and give us his presentation. Is it acceptable? Thank you. Prof. Ms. Nene, we thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to honourable members for inviting me here. I've been asked to outline the training programs that we at the University of the Western Cape at the Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies Plus offer, which I understand some members of the Portfolio Committee might be interested in attending. I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, but I have some packs here which contain application forms, and they also all contain a brochure which contains all the information that I'll be talking about. So the information is available to you in these packs. Just a little bit of background. We started a postgraduate training program in Land and Agrarian Studies in the year 2000. Before the program was initiated, we were in discussion with the Department then of Land Affairs and commissioned a professional training needs assessment, and over 100 people were interviewed. So we developed a curriculum based on what people in the sector, in government and outside government, thought was necessary in terms of skills, understanding, and analysis. The program has been supported by donors since its inception. And for the first 4 years, it was supported by the Norwegian government. Since 2005, it's been supported by the Belgian government. And the majority of students on our program have received bursaries. That may be phasing out. I'm not sure what the Belgian government is going to do. Those students who can be are supported by their employer often pay the full fees and if not required a bursary. From PLASA's point of view, we saw our role as a research institute who also does teaching and research, and training. It was our responsibility to try and build skills and capacity, enhanced capacity, both in government and outside government. And we continue to see a very dynamic link between our research, our teaching and training, and our policy engagement. And we try to have all three components inform one another. Over the past 9 years, we have had members of previous portfolio committees doing training with us. We had a previous chair of the Portfolio Committee on Land Affairs and Agriculture, that is Mr. Neo Mazzatella, was a student of ours. An MP, Mr. David Lally, was a student of ours. We've also had members, quite senior members of government, Mr. Mashile Makono, who was Chief Land Claims Commissioner in Mpumalanga and Limpopo, was a student for a while. And our courses also draw people from around the region. So this is not just South African. The course content covers a broader set of issues in Southern Africa to some extent, although the main emphasis is on South Africa. And we usually have four or five members out of students out of maybe 15 to 20, sometimes more than that, six or seven, from other Southern African countries. They've come as far afield, from as far afield as Tanzania, but mostly it's Zimbabwe, Namibia, Mozambique, sometimes Zambia, and so on, Swaziland. And the mix of students in the classes is usually quite interesting, because it's people working for government, people working for NGOs, people from other Southern African countries. And as a result, there's a lot of lively discussion and debate within the class. We like to not just do chalk and talk, but to put up ideas and propositions and then encourage people to read and then think about it and put forward their own views and opinions, and to test those against the views of others and against those of the lecturer. So these are our active debates. Your content advisor, Mr. Manenji, was also a graduate of this program. So the aims and objectives of the program are to develop conceptual skills with regard to policy analysis and to policy formulation and program design. It's not really a hands-on how to manage a program kind of training course, because we reckon that's a practical hands-on second order of skills which we as academics are not necessarily the best people to train. But what we do think we can offer is a development of conceptual analysis skills, so that one can actually make sense of what are very complex kinds of problems, the very complex kinds of policies, which are designed to fundamentally alter deeply rooted agrarian structures and systems of land ownership. And in order for people engaged in this in the practical sphere, from government or outside government, just to understand the complexity, to be able to critically analyze policies, to be able to see the connections between different kinds of issues, we think is a valuable contribution, which can then inform the practical details of how they engage in implementation. We also aim to develop research skills for a minority of our students, those who are intent on becoming researchers in the field. So basically there are four kinds of qualifications on offer. The first one is a postgraduate diploma, and that takes 1 year to complete, and consists entirely of coursework. There are six modules which have to be completed to attain a postgraduate diploma in land and agrarian studies, and those can all be undertaken in 1 year. The second qualification is an MPhil, a Master in Philosophy in Land and Agrarian Studies. That will take a minimum of 2 years to complete. It consists undertaking the six modules for the postgraduate diploma, the coursework component, and in addition to that, a mini thesis, which is a piece of solid research conducted in the field, which is required to attain the MPhil. The third qualification is a master's by research. It's an MPhil without any coursework component, which consists entirely of a long thesis. And that is most appropriate for people who are going to become researchers and who are already familiar with the content in the sector. The fourth qualification we have on offer is a PhD. It's a generic PhD, but it is in effect in land and agrarian studies. Now, to date, in the 9 years since we started the program, we've probably graduated about 80 students. The majority of them are with a postgraduate diploma, probably about 50. I don't have the exact figures here. But we have maybe 20 to 25, or say 20 MPhils by coursework and mini-theses, and then we have another five or so full-length masters, and we've graduated about seven or eight PhDs. So the what are the entrance requirements for these different qualifications? For the postgraduate diploma, as indicated, you should have a first degree, so that is a postgraduate diploma. But in fact, we also, the majority of our students, in fact, or some of them come with degrees, but many come with certificates or diplomas. And they can gain access by presenting evidence that they have the requisite prior experience and engagement. And this in the university system is called recognition of prior learning, RPL criteria. And even if one doesn't have a degree, you can get access to the program if you've been working in the sector in one capacity or another. You can show you've got relevant experience and you have a certificate or a diploma. It is even possible for people without a certificate or diploma, and in one case, even a person without a matric, to gain access to the program if they can convince us that their prior experience is relevant. There are certain things you have to write and so on, just to indicate that you have the relevant experience. So the entrance requirements are not a major obstacle. In order to register for the MPhil, you should have a first degree, but again, recognition of prior learning can count. But as we move on to the more research-oriented qualifications, the MPhil by research and the PhD, we really do require evidence that one has a solid academic foundation, that your skills with regards to academic reading and writing are solid enough. It is possible to register for a postgraduate diploma, and then if you attain an average mark of 65% across the six coursework modules, to in fact then move to re-register as an MPhil student and undertake the mini thesis. And in fact, if someone registers for an MPhil thesis and does the coursework but does not attain a mark of 65%, then we recommend that they exit with a postgraduate diploma, because that mini thesis research work does require one to have a very solid foundation, and that's what the coursework. So we try to maintain academic standards. We believe that one of the problems in our education system at large is that we don't give people sufficient grounding for expecting them to do difficult work. And so, and that's why we try to get people to register in the first instance at the appropriate level. So the majority of our students are postgraduate diploma students. A smaller number are MPhil by coursework and mini thesis, an even smaller number by MPhil research, and an even smaller number by PhD. So that's the kind of structure of the degree. If you're doing the let me just talk quickly about the core of our postgraduate program, which is the six modules. In fact, we have a large number of modules on offer, but at any 1 year we only offer six. These are most of our students are in full-time employment, so they attend the courses on a part-time basis, and basically there are three teaching blocks a year. And each teaching block is 2 weeks long. So when we'll come for 2 weeks in February, March, 2 weeks in May, and 2 weeks in September. In each teaching block, one will do two modules. So it's 2 plus 2 plus 2. Okay. In each teaching module, there's a lot of intensive reading and teaching and discussion during that two-week period. But one also has to do work before and after the module. So before each 2 weeks teaching block, there are two pre-contact assignments to do. And those are one for each module. So one has to do some reading and then some writing before one attends the the teaching block. And then during the teaching block, there might be a class test or some other kind of exercise which is marked. And then after the teaching block, there's a post-contact assignment, which is usually the bulk of the marks that you get. Okay? So one has to, in fact, do reading and writing outside of that intensive two-week period. And some people struggle to fit it into their work schedule. But since our student body is mainly drawn from the world of practitioners who are working full-time, who very rarely have full-time students, that's simply unavoidable. So the six modules which we've offered over the last 2 years are as follows. The first module is the history of the land question in South Africa. So here we try to develop an understanding of how we got to this point where land was so unequally distributed and rural poverty was the massive problem that it was. And it's an in-depth analysis of the various policies of the past which created this highly unequitable land dispensation. And we have historians teaching that module from University of Western Cape and often from University of Cape Town as well. The second module is called The Agrarian Question in Southern Africa, and it focuses on Southern and South Africa in particular and tries to give an understanding of the debates around land reform policy. It involves an in-depth treatment of policies around redistribution, restitution, and tenure reform, as well as agricultural policies and questions of post-settlement support. It puts us in the context of other similar policies in other Southern African countries, like in Namibia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique, but it's a very in-depth examination of our own, South Africa's land reform program. And, of course, many of the crucial debates around that are in. The third module is called Land and Agrarian Reform in Contemporary Africa, Comparative Perspectives and Policy Debates. And this is an in-depth examination of some of the fundamental underlying questions about land, agriculture, livelihoods, and poverty. And it gets into a little bit of theory. And it examines, for example, different conceptions of what the agrarian question is. We might, for example, compare and contrast a Marxist understanding of the agrarian question, which has been so influential around the world, to compare that to the neoclassical economics understanding of the agrarian question, which are around small farming, efficiency, whether or not there are economies of scale in agriculture. And then, again, a third version will be the debate around property rights. We have debates between, for example, those who emphasize that private property is essential, and the key Peruvian thinker Hernando de Soto is the most famous contemporary exponent of that view, versus ideas that private property is not absolutely necessary for development to take place, that other forms of land holding, like communal tenure or what some people call renovated or democratized forms of traditional land tenure, are equally valid. So there's a big debate about property rights. And again, here we look at international perspectives and look beyond South Africa itself. The fourth module is called The Economics of Agrarian Systems, and it really tries to give people without formal economics training a grounding in these very important economic dimensions of land and agrarian reform. We look at different kinds of agrarian systems and the economic aspects, economic arguments for and against land reform, and the impact or performance of different kinds of land and agrarian reform policies. It includes then issues around building basic economic literacy in terms of terminology and so on. And we have a specialist agricultural economist, also one of the experts on South African land reform, Dr. Michael Alaba, and our staff teaching that module. The fifth module on offer the last couple of years has been one on a broader set of issues, which are sustainable rural livelihoods and integrated development. So here we want to locate questions of land and agrarian reform in a wider set of debates about the nature of poverty and inequality and ways of thinking about rural livelihoods and the multiple and diverse nature of livelihoods, and also think about what that means for planning and how one can. So that's actually really begins to address the new focus on rural comprehensive rural development. And I think we're going to have to bring some of the debates currently around comprehensive rural development into that module. It also touches briefly on issues of HIV, AIDS, and gender and poverty. The sixth module at the moment is one on the legal and socio-legal dimensions of land and agrarian reform. So this has an in-depth look at what law is and how it's administered and the evolution of land law in South Africa, but a very in-depth analysis of current land reform laws in South Africa, including the Restitution Act, the various tenure reform acts, including ESTA, Labor Tenants Act, Communal Land Rights Act, and then a little bit of a look at the legal provisions which enable redistribution as well. So we have specialist lawyers from the Legal Resources Center who are not just academics, but practitioners also teaching that module. So that's basically the modules we're on offer. In the past, we used to offer a module on sustainable natural resource management, looking at issues around water, forests, wildlife, and grazing land as well. But that's not on offer just at the moment. We might go back to that. There's also a module on research methods for those who are going to do the MPhil and PhDs. So that's a little bit about what the ground that is covered. The application process, I have the PACs here. You basically have to fill in two forms, one for the university and one for PLAS itself. You have to do a little bit of writing. You have the question which is posed to you, how important are land-based livelihoods in the 21st century in Southern Africa? And we ask you to write down in your own words whether you think they're important or not, so we get a sense of how well you understand these issues and whether you can write in a reasonably coherent way. And that helps inform our decision whether or not to accept you as a student. We usually get about 50 to 60 applications, and we usually take about 20 students. That's about as much as we can handle at one time. The cost of these courses, it's approximately 15,000 rand at the moment for the diploma, another 15,000 for the PhD. It's approximately the same for an MPhil by research and PhD, although you pay a little bit if you're doing a PhD over 4 years, say. After paying the first large sum, you pay another 1,000 rand or 1,200 rand a year subsequently. So it's a bit more expensive if you're doing the longer degrees. Yeah, I think I've just about covered all the ground, I think, Madam Chair. I'm happy to entertain questions.
There we are, honourable members. Any questions for Professor? Honourable Fuate and Honourable Msimang.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Prof. I've seen that the brochure that was circulating, it is stating that the closing date is the 30th of September. Does that mean that if you can't fill those if you can't actually apply before that time, you are going to be closed outside? Thank you.
We try to process applications early so that there are no delays, but often we do accept later applications. But I would say that the end of October is the absolute outside limit. Beyond that is unlikely. But if you can't meet the 30th of September deadline, please try and make the deadline as soon as possible thereafter.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The Professor mentioned two assignments before the intensive conduct sessions and one assignment thereafter. But what about the exams? Do we write exams after each conduct session or after everything? Thank you.
There are no actual exams as such. Each module has approximately 15% of the marks derived from the pre-contact assignment, another 35% from a test, or if you like, an exam, or some other form of assessment during the contact period, and then about 50% will come from the post-contact assignment. So there are no other exams other than those module-specific forms of assessment.
Yeah, Prof, I think we have one member who has shown interest in this, and unfortunately she did not pitch up today, and I was requested by the chairperson, because I'm the acting chairperson, I'm the whip of the committee, in fact, to convey her needs, and I'm not sure how should I put it, but I think she is a person who has to go through a bit, but she was very much interested in the course. I don't know how those people in your presentation, how can you be able to assist them in that regard, because she's not here to talk on her behalf. It's unfortunate.
And in a full chairperson for academic courses, a basic amount of academic literacy is actually necessary. Many of our students do struggle. Most of them are not. It's English that people are working their second language. So, writing expression is a challenge. On the one hand, we're supportive and do provide some additional assistance where we can with writing skills and so on. On the other hand, we can't afford to relax our minimum standards too much, or we will lose credibility. I mean, it depends very much on the person. A little bit of inexactitudes with regards to writing and so on we can live with, but they have to really be articulating a clear set of ideas. If someone is really struggling, then I think they should complete an ABET program before undertaking a course. So it's hard to say without, considering the case in front of us. But we do try to be, we have people from NGOs who have been activists, as I said, one person didn't even have a matric. It depends very much on, the sort of clarity of thinking of that person. Then struggles with language you can accommodate. And I'll just say one other thing while people are thinking of questions. We are very well aware that this program cannot meet the capacity needs of our society on its own. We only have maybe 20 to 25, 30 students registered each year. And there are many people working in the sector who do need skills. There's been a very high turnover in government. So people come in, learn, and then leave. So there's a larger question, which I actually touched on speaking at your workshop in Gordon's Bay about building the capacity of government in particular. We used to run a lot of short course training in the mid-90s and have in fact trained over 500 people, government and non-governmental, in short course training. And those were working closely with the Department of Land Affairs. I think there's a bigger question here about capacity building for government, I think we need a new conversation between the department and various kinds of service providers about in-service training to build capacity in the government. So I think from your side as legislators, you can actually ask questions to the executive about how they are building capacity in government. We actually asked the Belgians if they would fund a short course program starting this year, and they said that they can't afford it at the moment. But, it needn't be only plots, it could be a range of people, but I think there really is a need to develop skills. So I think that's an urgent question for the, you know, which is actually necessary for successful implementation of what are inherently challenging, complex policies and programs. So that's another perspective, I think, on this whole question of training.
Honourable Member.
I think all of us were interested in this course, but I was just thinking about these two full time weeks of that contact session. I don't know how possible is it for us as members, the two full time weeks for contact session, but I think we need to look at that and just can we?
Madam Chair, if there are several members of the Portfolio Committee intending to register, the exact dates of those two-week blocks are not fixed in stone. So if you have some sense of your program, your own program for next year, it might be possible to adjust the dates so that they fit in with your program. But that would have to be communicated, you know, well in advance, so that it could be taken into account. We also, since we're relying on people from outside class and other departments and the LRC and so on to do training, we have to fit in with their schedule as well. But I think advance warning, for example, a period when you're not required to be in Parliament, might help us set dates which are more suitable for you. It's a planning matter, I think.
Yeah, I think, Prof, we have a situation where through planning also the course on economics and public finance that is offered, the venue mostly for members is here in Parliament, and I found it to be working very well. Will it be the same situation here where from time to time, the venue will be here, not at the university, because some of us don't even know where to go when you want to go to the university.
Well, we haven't ever done that before. And it's probably not impossible if it's planned well in advance. It depends very much what you feel your need is. If it's for certification, that is to have a piece of paper, a diploma, a degree, then the formal requirements of our course have to be met. If your need really is to have guided reading and to develop your understanding, and it's not so much the certification which is the issue, then there might be an alternative route altogether, which is a custom-designed short course for members of Parliament, which leads to a certificate of attendance rather than a formal academic certificate, which could be at a venue of convenience, at a time of convenience, which could be specially designed. That would be a non-certified alternative of the kind of short course that we used to do for government. That would be something which we could also discuss, I think.
Okay.
I think the second option maybe in our case, if we're all interested, because I think if I look around the table, most of us is interested in this course. If we can maybe discuss another option of how we can do this, because I was also thinking about this 2 weeks, and it's all good and fine, but you know, to set it in, we also have constituency weeks and other weeks. Usually when you don't sit in Parliament, you have other things
right
to do at that stage. I think we might, as a committee, discuss this amongst ourselves and see if we're really interested in it, and that we can meet and discuss how we can do this, so that we plan a separate module specifically designed for us. I think at this stage that's an option.
There are no more questions. Thank you, Prof. And I think we will take it from here as a committee, and then we'll communicate with yourselves so that we inform you exactly what is our way forward.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, we have the last, and I'm told it's going to take only 5 minutes presentation. And I'm told it's only 5 minutes.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Mava Lugali, is the surname. I'm coming from Parliamentary Communication Service, from the Information and Content Development Subunit. Parliamentary Communication Services is a section within Parliament which is responsible for communication services. The unit I'm here to present is located within Parliamentary Communication Services. Introduction. Information and Content Development Unit, as I've already said, is a unit within Parliamentary Communication Services. One of its tasks is to provide strategic communication to committees and the two houses of Parliament. It's doing so in the context of the objectives, within the context of the objectives of the Parliamentary Communication Services, by providing the content support to committees and houses in the manner that promotes the image and better understanding of Parliament. Providing the communication support in the manner that promotes public education and public participation. Provide communication support to the legislative and oversight role of Parliament. The unit has got its the objective of the unit is to provide access to information on issues before Parliament and workings of Parliament and its committees. Access to information on draft bills that are being considered by the committees, on oversight work conducted by the committees, debates taking place in the Houses of Parliament, and special events such as taking Parliament with the people and people's assembly. How does Information and Content Development subunit support committees? By the production and distribution of press statements, facilitate interaction between members of Parliament and media. We organize press briefings whenever the committee chairperson asks us to organize a press briefing. We do so. We identify as a subunit media opportunities, challenges, and threats We also gave media advice to committees. We manage media during public hearings. We monitor media coverage of committees to ensure that distortions are corrected, whatever the media says, which misleads the public. We handle branding. When, for instance, the committee is conducting an oversight in a province, we use that opportunity to brand Parliament. We go along with banners and leaflets. We identify, gather, and develop information from committee meetings for website and parliamentary radio and publications that are produced in Parliament, like in sessions. Parliament has got more than 50 committees, portfolio committees and select committees, ad hoc committees and other committees. The information and content development subunit has got only few principal officers that are supposed to support each and every committee. We ensure that each principal communications office supports not less than 10 committees. Like I am here now, I'm supporting this committee, World Development Portfolio Committee, and other 9 committees. My name is Marvez. I've already introduced myself. We work the protocol on press statements. We work on 2 types of statements. First of all, we release a media invite or press alert. That's one of the statements. The second statement is a statement that puts forward the position taken by a committee on a particular issue. How do we make the statement? The principal communications officer, like myself, will draft a statement in consultation with the chairperson of the committee. Work on the draft, the chairperson approves it. After the chairperson has approved it, we release it to media. We've got an updated media database. In the unit, there is a media specialist. The person who looks at the statement, if the statement meets the journalistic standard and is a correct, is written according to journalistic way of writing statements. I think I've finished. Yeah. Our deadlines for statements, Chairperson, are largely determined or influenced by the news gatherings in the media newsrooms. For instance, the media newsrooms have got 2 media gatherings. The first one will be about sending reporters to news sources. The last news gathering will take place at 3:30 for daily newspapers. We ensure that deadline is before that 3:30. So that the daily newspaper can also write about the statement we have sent to it. That is the end of my presentation, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Executive First Minister. I'm not sure if members are still very keen on interrogating the presentation, or do we say we'll need a time when in a committee where we'll call him again to come and do proper work? Up to you, members. Honorable Stein?
I just wanted to ask one question. I don't know if there's other questions, but if there's more questions, we might ask you to come back, but I don't know how many questions there is.
Can I have any indication from members if there are questions? I think you can proceed, Ms. Tay.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to find out if something from this committee is sent out, is it also sent to the members of this committee? Because it's something that really upsets me if I read something in the newspapers about something happening in this committee, but we as members haven't seen, I don't want us to see it beforehand or something, but it must just be sent to us as a committee. I just wanted to find out how does it work. I see that the chairperson is drafting it, whatever, but is it also sent to the members of the committee if we send out a statement?
Chair, as I have already said, that we interact with the chairperson. We take the chairperson as the spokesperson of the committee. So we only interact with him. Once he approves the statement, we send it out. We take it for granted that is the position of the committee.
No more questions. Honorable members, I would like to thank you for participating in this workshop, and I hope that we have learned a lot, and I hope that we are going to utilize the information that we got in order to further enhance our capacity so that we are able to execute our responsibility in this committee. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Parliament, yeah. Oh.